Check.
I will not be curing gluten today. Celiac one, please.
So do you want to make change right now?
No, I don't want to do it now. I'll just no. But I didn't think it was 10 weeks.
I think originally he told me that he's like, if he was asked, I think we were going back and forth how long they had, and like, he says, well, I'm going to check, and I said, it's from me. He's like, oh, I can take them to him, and then I could find them, and he tells me to try. So
good. See you later.
Okay.
Check.
These ones will work, but perhaps if we can do them, see if Dr. Collins.
Check. One, two. Check. Check. One, two. Check. One, two. Check. One, two. Check. One, two.
Dr. Balbuffet is the one with the Mac presentation. Yeah. You're a Mac man.
I am.
Okay.
You are. I tried to speak before PowerPoint for Mac work, but my videos didn't work on this laptop.
How did you change since you went to school?
A little bit.
Hi.
Hi. Hi. Do you have an HDMI?
Sure.
Yep.
So you won't use this one?
No. Okay, not to see.
How are you doing?
No, I don't.
Do you have a laptop? Yeah, do you have an HDMI?
No, not in this.
I don't have a VGA on mine. It's a MacBook Pro. There's no connections other than USB, HDMI, or Thunderbolt.
Why? How many people are supposed to come?
Close to, I think
there's
150 signed up.
Yeah,
about
like 75,
okay.
Yeah.
No, trust me.
Really?
No. I have people like emailing me
don't
at midnight. I didn't sign up.
Just do dead air for 10 minutes. Like, who's going to care?
Look at this.
What?
Look at this.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Did you not bring yours?
Hey, where'd the guy go, Maya?
Sorry.
Oh, there he is.
Yeah, he's here. He is not.
I thought he left.
No.
He's not. It's been transferred to another computer.
I have, and you said it doesn't run on your computer. Well, none of my videos were
maybe you guys can get
out of at home.
There we go.
So, like, every light you have, if you're coming up, oh, what's going on? What's wrong? You know, like, 1 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 1:30 in the morning, all the lights are on, the kids up. It's all bad, you know, like. Son's asleep in bed, he's got these lights on.
Yeah, they don't like to turn the lights off. My kids are the same way.
Nothing, you know? It's worse than us. I remember my parents' voice. Shut up the lights, but man, it's like, you know, you don't shut the computer, you don't shut the lights, you don't shut anything.
My kids the same way. My daughter won't turn off the lights and go to bed. She'll keep every light on in the house and then maybe fall asleep on the couch waiting for us.
So my both my kids just got the driver's license. And my son was, my son stays in Toronto.
Do you have some, like, do you have some, like, wire might be working? Do you have some? Get that press.
No, I don't have anything like that.
Go to the car, which is parked. Where he was, where he'd been. Like, you know, like, what's the deal here?
Did you notice there's a ticket fluttering to the windshield?
No, not only that, it didn't occur to him that he had to pay the parking meter. Like, he was parked at a meter, but it just didn't occur to him that he would have to pay it.
The things he learned, it's, well, it's better than my friend's daughter who borrowed the BMW diesel.
Oh, and put,
put gas in, even though they told her. So she went to the gas station. Oh. She sees that there's a big sign that says diesel.
She goes up to the normal pump.
She says, Dad,
I can see my kids doing that. Not my son, my daughters. I can see them. Because they're smart, but.
And you just might want to change the resolution to 1024/768. Just try and
read
it.
I'll just get it, but Carolyn.
So do you want to try here? You know what? I brought a stick. And you can try seeing if the videos will work on your...
Why don't you download it to your stick as a show? Then they're embedded. PowerPoint show.
Okay, I can try that. I think they are embedded, because I...
Oh, then you're going to be fine.
But I think it's because it's QuickTime that it uses to play the videos instead of... It's not a WMV.
That's why you can't.
You do scaled. It doesn't have that. That's why. Let's turn this mic off so that not everybody hears us.
Yeah, she's
going
to apply for seizures. There's actually no panic at all going on in the house.
So, here, try. Yeah, and then I'll guide you to where.
She's a mother. They're pretty. It was like pretty important. I mean, you literally, like, Alex, a good expert.
Worst case scenario, I'll have to pick them from here and show them on this.
In the morning, I was I was thinking I'm a little too drunk for the talk tomorrow. I snapped up, man. I'm from a trauma surgeon.
I've got a lot of videos and stuff. Yeah.
Stop.
Stop,
man.
It's a flash.
I know what we're going to do with Ramin.
What? You going to the game tonight?
So I know what we're going to do with some of the funds that we raised.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Good point. I don't get it. I've given lectures here. Small group now, you know, like a lot of small, like they've gone to like groups of 20 people, come to the hospital and give them like a kind of pragmatic, goal-oriented lecture and ask questions. And not like, there's not so many, I don't give lectures yet.
I do probably about 2 a year, just like the major meetings, but then like you said, the rest of them are all small groups. But that, because of that, when I got this MacBook Pro, so the retina display and all, everybody's projectors are old, I just bought my own projector and I take it with me. Because, but here, you know, couldn't be done to go. You know what? Don't worry about it. What we'll do is I'll just run the videos from there. Because otherwise...
Because I put all the videos here. Well, there's another solution. So you can like manually select, just reading all the videos.
Why can't
like 2 minutes.
Because they can't hook this up. Oh, they don't know how to hook. They don't have a... I can't believe you guys don't have an HDMI.
Yeah, okay. One of the few theaters around that doesn't have an HDMI, unfortunately.
Okay.
Wow.
So you serve and just
take a workaround on or not?
Yeah. I'm just gonna. What I'm gonna do is I'm gonna just have the videos there, and when it comes to it, I'll just go back and click on the video, and then we'll play it that way.
That'd be fine.
Yeah.
So for microphones, you need this or a lab mic.
Okay.
TED Talk. Do the TED Talk.
I just want to see the one for surgery. So what are these things? Okay, so I just keep that. That's easy for me to see.
Should, yeah.
No, I want to mute it during.
You mute the audio? Yeah.
That's taking us so long to load.
Put all your videos on the
device.
Okay. Okay. So then you go from there?
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to see which one it has to be because there's 2 copies of each one. So this one. Yeah. Maybe the first one of each one. Yeah, that works. Okay. That one. Yeah. And that one.
I scoring of decimates.
Turned off the
volume? Yeah,
turned off. Okay. Okay, so no problem. I got everything now.
we have to get four more talks loaded, eh?
Yeah.
So let's get the talks loaded. Sorry, guys.
Can we pull these USB keys, please?
So done.
Did you? Yeah, I got that. This is the dream presentation.
Yeah, that's true. I cared like at 3 o'clock it was up to me. And it might be bad now because I was pretty happy. I started priming it on Monday night in Tampa. I said, I've got it. One of my buddies said, we have the one in the middle of the Saturday night. Yeah, we're all too old to do that.
Is everything okay with the presentation so far? Are they running all right?
Well, we just had one because I was a Mac. We didn't have the right connection.
Yeah,
that took a while.
So now we're going to get the talks.
Yeah. Perfect.
Is Ron done? Can we go get the talks? Yeah, okay, let's do it. I'm used to hitting deadlines, you know what I'm saying? Let's just hit it.
Award ceremony, final graduation, CME seminar.
Yeah, sorry.
That was stuff in the eye.
Okay, you need to open it and check if there's speaker notes.
Yeah, we're all lined up, trying to get it in. How you doing, Art? And Harvey, don't worry, it's okay though. Yeah, that's just okay. Ron, the Ron's the guy who makes a lot of money. It's just.
Okay. And you're talking
on. Ah, come on.
Where's that guy?
Yeah, you know what? We should do that. When we came out to the American Academy, this is a group of us coming out as president, and
okay, can you go back to the key? Check the PowerPoint presentation. Just open it up. Sure, that's it. Okay.
It's okay or what? Yeah.
Open up the rest of theirs.
Iris, you're in the first session, right? Put yours in. You're in the first session? Make sure you're in.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Make sure yours is in.
I'm at 20.
Yeah, put yours in.
So David.
So what I need is this
work. Okay. Who's next?
And this is the screen, and you can see what's the content. And and all the materials are going to be.
I'm going to be doing, let me just make sure I understand, I'm going to be doing this, and then I'm going like here.
Is everything okay so far? Are things all going to run? Do we have any issues?
No, we just got a little too slow.
So if I want to go back?
That's fine, because the dean's not here yet. Oh, sorry.
How do I do it? So previous will be here. Let's just right, click, left, click.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start it from the beginning. Okay, great. So you can set it up for me in the hall.
You know Ed, right?
Yeah.
Don't I remember the two guys in the
TB or tuberculosis. It's scrolling out, it should be an alphabetical one. There we go. Yep. Put that on the desktop.
Ghostwriter?
Yeah, it should be. It's pretty. There's nothing special in there, so yeah, it looks like it's all good.
Any videos?
No videos. No. Nothing fancy. Do you mind just.
Yeah, sorry.
Want me to plug it in?
Yeah.
Everyone left their keys?
Presentation with the dean because there's something screwed up.
Got it. He had a hard time putting through out there.
It's Avian Homecoming, I think. This one here. Yeah, that one. I don't need to go through the talk. Just okay? Can I take this out now? No.
Yeah, you can. It's
finished. I have the key.
Alright.
Presentation. You should have it here already.
Yeah, but like, kind of.
It doesn't matter if it's on or off, you know.
Well, it's.
Go back to the first one, first slide.
Diana puts this on here. When is it more in? That's me. Okay, let me take a look at this. Thank you. Yeah, that's it.
So do you like do you need to like see the notes?
I do not need to. I do not need to see the notes. Just, just make sure I know where it is. So
yeah,
I can,
so,
that one there.
Yeah.
I'm just here to take up time. So.
Okay.
Okay.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I got it.
That's mine.
build this sign of building. Let's see if it works. Perfect.
Presentations are there? I'm not sure. Each one of those is one.
Yeah, but
so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay, so just cross-reference and see who's who. So that's the first one. For Shami is that one. The Deans is here. Okay. Yeah. Susan Kovacs, just go through them. Hold it. Look, there's seven. He speaks twice.
Yeah.
Raman speaks twice. So there should be only seven, not eight.
Yeah.
So we're fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It works.
speakers have a choice of the podium microphone and now it's on.
Yeah.
Okay?
So realize on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Here, this is up here. Yeah. One, two.
So I've got like closer. So it has to be like a little bit closer.
Right here.
Are you gonna see how many of these do we have? One, right? One for the speaker?
Yeah.
Perfect. So, Dr. Cook? Great. Okay, good morning. So we'll get started. 9:30. Thank you all for coming. I'm assuming people are filling their standard classroom positions. I know members of my class have taken. I see Rob Feiler back there still looking for oxygen. Thank you very much. We're missing the NTC Club members in front to take notes. But it's very nice to have you. I have to tell you, this is a very unusual event because if you know our class, have a CME event the morning after a party is just not a good idea. We would have been fairly good in the afternoon, but it's going to be interesting to see if my colleagues can speak. But we'll do their best. We had a terrific dinner last night, and it's really fun to be back here at McGill. So a few things before we get started. I wanted to welcome Dean Eidelman. Thank you very much for coming this morning. And we'll get more details on that in a few minutes on the proceedings for the morning. Fellow graduates, speakers, alumni and friends and faculty, and hopefully some McGill students. So welcome to all of you. The 25th anniversary medical seminar is a longstanding tradition here at the Faculty of Medicine, and we're proud to be able to present it again as members of the class of 89. The six brave speakers today who agreed to speak after a party, some voluntarily and few others not so voluntarily, who graciously agreed to speak. I want to thank them for being here, Drs. Susan Kovacs, Ron Baldessari, Iris Gorfinkel, Ed Harvey, Kevin Schwartzman, who are going to join me this morning. I would like to also ask our organizing committee, particularly Ed's support and help in putting this together, and Maya, I don't know where Maya is, Maya Zaremba, who was absolutely fabulous, so I don't know where she is, terrific support. I live in Boston, so this would have been impossible to do without really good support here on the ground. Okay, so some details of the CME, because this is an accredited seminar. I do want to again thank Ed, because not only he helped put the material together, he also helped complete the application to get the Royal College give us credits for being here, so we appreciate that. For the speakers, please remember to have your disclosure slides at the beginning of the presentations. For our participants, please remember to register. If you haven't registered, you need to do so because you will not get your credits otherwise. And please remember that you have to fill out the survey, make every effort to return the survey to a staff member at the end of the seminar. I'm actually pretty good at reading standard documents, so this is great. These must be returned to the Continuing Health Professional Education Office. We have different names for these in the United States, and I will spare you of those, but of similar challenge. And that's required for our CME. So I would like to introduce the dean. Most of you probably know David. David is a native Montrealer, a McGill graduate, and he is the vice principal of health affairs and dean of the Faculty of Medicine. He started his appointment in January 1 of 2012, so in the past 3 years he has been our dean. He served as a director of, he actually served for 7 years previous to that as the chair of medicine, Faculty of Medicine, and the physician-in-chief at McGill University Health Center. And he was also leading our respiratory diseases division here at McGill. After receiving his MD at McGill in 79, so he had his 35-year reunion last night, which I guarantee you would have been nowhere close to our party. I did invite him to stay, but he had to run and make a presentation or be there at least for his own class. David continued his training in internal medicine at the University of Toronto at St. Michael's Hospital and then at Toronto General. He returned to Montreal shortly thereafter to pursue advanced training in respiratory medicine and research at McGill. He's an accomplished clinician scientist whose research in inflammatory disorders of the airways is based at the Meekins Christie Laboratories in Montreal. He brings extensive knowledge of the Quebec healthcare system to his position of vice principal and dean of medicine, and he's an active leader in clinical medicine and research in Canada and internationally. And I have to say, he is a tremendous person to interact with, and I've enjoyed every conversation, even when he came down to Boston for a couple of months and we grabbed some lunch together. So we're really lucky to have him here as our dean. So, David.
Thank you very much, Ramin. Okay, here we go. So, good morning, everybody. I gather, thank you very much. F5, there we go. Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. We did not have as good a class party as you guys did in the 25th year class, but it ended very late. So I'm a little out of it this morning, and I'm very impressed to see so many of you here. I want to congratulate the 25th year class. I heard that they set an all-time record for fundraising in a single evening, so congratulations to Ramin and all the organizers. My job this morning is to just give you a little hint of what's going on here in the faculty. So among the things that are going on is medical school, I remember where I sat also in this class. A medical school is not exactly the same as it was. I'm sure those of you who are at McGill are aware of this. Those of you who are elsewhere have seen these changes in your own environments. But a key issue with our new curriculum, which we're calling Patient at Heart, Science in Hand, is to at the same time put together a more active learning type approach with students having early exposure to patients, with the need to develop skills in self-directed learning and lifelong learning. Whoops. I'm really not at my best this morning. That never happens. Okay. So in our new curriculum, we're looking at taking people along a pathway that will lead them to becoming solid health professionals by giving them the opportunity to do much more problem-based learning than we had when we were students. Even this class in 25-year, the 25-year class had a lot of lectures, a lot of self-directed learning. Also, we have compulsory research projects. Everybody has to be involved in a community engagement project. And there's a lot more integration of learning of clinical skills with systems learning. I have to tell you, I went to my dinner last night, and most of the conversation... It's hard to be the dean and be at a party because instead of being able to talk about old times, I had to answer questions about our admissions program. So let me just say that it's hard to get into medical school now. It was hard to get into medical school. We went to medical school, and everybody in this room went to medical school, but it's even harder to get in now. And many of you will know there's been an explosion of offshore medical schools in the Caribbean and Israel and Australia, all over the world. People are running medical schools to try because there's such a demand. We're very fortunate here to get great students. You are great students. The students we get now are great. One of the big changes that happened in Canada is we don't take very many students from outside the country, which we used to do. When I was at the 50-50 year class last night, in their year, about 25% of the class was American. And in the year before, the 50th year class, the class of 63, half the class was American. That was just the way it was. It's not like that anymore. We have, like all the Canadian medical schools, we take almost all our students from our home province. But because of our admissions, our recruitment process, let's say, put it that way, we actually get an enormously diverse group of students. They come basically from every CEGEP, but, you know, from universities like McGill and Harvard, and from all across Canada, from many different countries of origin. Many of our students are either first or the children of first-generation immigrants, and most of our students, almost all our students, are bilingual. A very large plurality are trilingual, and we have a very, very rich multicultural environment. It's a really cool place, just as it was when you were here, because you were here. Another thing that hasn't changed in McGill is, of course, is our focus on excellence. Our educational program aims to be the most innovative one in North America, and at the same time, we continue to strive for excellence in our research programs. As those who are involved in research will know, it's become increasingly difficult to be successful in research. Certainly in Canada and the United States, there have been enormous cutbacks in research funding. I had the pleasure of seeing our Lifetime Achievement Alumni Award winner yesterday at lunchtime, Dr. Erwin Gelfand, who people in allergy or respiratory will know is a real world authority. And he talked about the National Jewish Hospital in Colorado, which some of you will know, and how it's had enormous downsizing of its scientific enterprise just because people can't get grants. I want you to know that despite all these pressures, we're doing very, very well and continue to do well, and in fact have developed a new strategic research plan under the direction of our outstanding Vice Dean Research, Life Sciences Research, Philippe Gros, which is trying to build on the strengths of McGill. We're very strong in genomics, computational biology, imaging, and a number of other areas, and I think that we're going to continue to be leaders in research in general. One of the things that we've developed, which probably wasn't very strong when you were here, is research in family medicine. So family medicine, when I was a student, was an afterthought, and everybody knows of the importance of primary care. And a big change that's happened is, under the direction of Howard Bergman, who's also having, his class is having one of the anniversaries this year, under direction of Howard Bergman in the 45th year class, family medicine has become an intensively academic program, including a large graduate program with master's and PhD students. And we hope that that's going to be nicely complementary to our existing strengths in biomedical research. And in that regard, we're also developing, we've been very fortunate to be effecting a major cultural change. People who train here will remember, especially the people from the older classes, will remember the rivalries between the Vic and the General, and the Jewish, and so on. That's largely changed, in part because the Vic and the General are part of the McGill University Health Center, but also there's been a recognition that we have to have a critical mass of people working together. Through the generosity of the Rossi Family Foundation, some of you have heard of Dollarama, that's who it is, have allowed us to develop a strong cancer care network that's going to serve as a basis for both outstanding care as well as research and teaching. We've been very fortunate, you can see, to be growing our global health programs. We just were able to appoint Madhu Pai, some of you will know, and certainly Kevin will know, is an international authority in the world of tuberculosis and very, very well known in the global health field. We have, obviously, projects around the world. Some will know that in the context of the Ebola crisis, Joanne Liu, who's based at Saint-Justine but is one of our students from the MDCM 91 and is head of Médecins Sans Frontières, has been very active. We have a growing global health impact, which I think is going to literally explode over the next few years and should watch for growing prominence of global health. Some of you went to the seminar yesterday. I think Tarek Razak gave it. If you didn't, you missed something. Those of us who have heard Tarek talk, we have a really extraordinary global surgery program in which Tarek and Dan Deckelbaum and their teams go around the world helping third world countries and developing countries come up with ways of dealing with trauma. Trauma is one of the areas in global health that's been largely neglected, even though you can imagine if you have a traumatic injury in one of those places, your ability to earn a living is eliminated. So we're very excited about what we're doing in global health. Many of you will know about the new MUHC. You probably drove by it if you came in from the airport, may not know what it was. It's a very large structure. Kevin, I'm looking at Kevin here and Ed, and they will tell you that it's not large enough. But nevertheless, it is a state-of-the-art facility that is really going to be very exciting. The research part of it, the Center for Translational Biology, will open in February. We already have started having our technicians and stuff go in there and get the place ready. They're starting to breed the animals in the animal facility. The clinical part of the hospital, which will include the Royal Vic, the Montreal Chest, the Montreal Children's, and a new cancer center, will open, will start to come into effect between April and June of 2015, so very, very soon. We expect that that's really going to revolutionize care. Many people ask me what's going to happen to the Vic and the Children's and so on. I don't know. Do you have $1 billion? Because if you do, I can sell you the Vic. The Montreal General is going to be staying open and will be our center for trauma, orthopedics, thoracic surgery, inflammatory bowel disease, and a few other programs, while the most of the other activities will be at the Glen site. Meanwhile, you can see up in the corner here, there's a picture, which I believe is a picture of the Jewish. Yes, it is. So the Jewish has just opened the K Pavilion, a new pavilion, and has a new emergency room. And it's very, which is really extremely exciting place to work. So there's a lot of changes going on in the physical structures of our hospital, but at the same time, those who are in Quebec will know that our new health minister, who used to be our union leader, is now re-changing the entire healthcare system, and we're waiting to see how that's going to pan out in terms of its impact on education and research. So getting back to the MUHC, people always want to know what's going to happen. So here we go. In February, the Research Institute moves. In April, the Royal Vic. Patients go to the Glen. In May, on May 24th, the Children's moves. And on June 14th, the last few patients will move in. So by Fête Saint-Jean, the new MUHC will be up and running. The other thing that I do a lot of now is I travel because we're trying to build international partnerships. People of relatively recent vintage will remember we've always had a lot of residents coming from the Middle East. But in addition to that, we're trying to build partnerships in the Middle East, in China, and in Eastern Europe to try and develop, to extend the McGill footprint out into the world. And that's that turns out to be a very exciting but a very complex task, but I think it has a lot of potential. So here's a picture of the 25th year class. No. So this is you guys, the 25th year class. And what a good-looking bunch of people you are. So I want to congratulate all the returnees, all the people here celebrating their reunions. Particularly the 25th year class, I want to thank you for organizing this symposium this morning. Thank you all for showing up so early. For some reason, my advertising slide went away. Keep in mind that tonight at 5 o'clock, between 5 and 8, we have a very exciting and innovative cocktail party. I will be there. I should be awake by then. It will be at the Windsor Hotel, as it once was known, or now known as Le Windsor, and it should be a lot of fun. I look forward to seeing you there. Thank you very much. Do you want me to ask a question? Are there any questions? Last time I gave a talk, I forgot to ask a question. Yes, sir.
Any U.S. students anymore?
There's four.
There were no U.S. universities there.
Not this year. Last year we had Harvard, Columbia, and a few others. But those are usually Quebecers who've gone away who come back. Okay. So in Canada, like we have about 12 to 15 students from out of Quebec. That's more than they have in any other medical school, where Canadian, because we're publicly funded in Canada. So if you live in BC and you want to go to med school, you go to UBC, okay, pretty much, and so on, and that's just the way it is. And of course we would like to take more students from outside. I think it would be better for the class, but while tuition is $4,000, that's the kind of, we're basically a publicly funded institution, and so we have to follow the local rules. Yes, up there.
Couldn't you raise the tuition for international students and take more and have them pay their own way?
We could, but then they would subtract that from what they give us for the other students and punish us. It's actually quite difficult to do that. We've considered it. Remember that as a medical school, we are dependent on state-funded facilities to teach our students, notably the hospitals. And so you'll know that, let's say, the Caribbean medical schools, they pay American hospitals substantial amounts of money to take students to look after them. We do not pay the health ministry for access to the hospitals, right? So we've certainly thought about it. I think at this point in time, we're going to have to deal with that and watch for opportunities. We may have an opportunity as money becomes tighter, which is already very tight, to have some flexibility on that. Yes?
What about on the other end? What percent of the graduate students go to do their residencies in the States?
Fewer and fewer. Last year we only had, I think, four. Canadians used to migrate to the United States in large numbers. I know that was the case in your classes. Since the fee structure has changed in Canada, so that Canadian physicians in Quebec, they're pretty much at the American average or above. In places like Ontario and Alberta, people are making substantially more money than they make in the United States. So there hasn't been as much attraction for students to go to the United States for their training. I think most of the people who end up in academic positions spend some time in the United States, but usually at the fellowship or post-fellowship level. So I think it's very similar in the other part. My understanding, in fact, from McGill, about 30, it depends on the year, between 25 and 40% of the class will leave the province, depending on who's in government at that time and how aggravating, things are. So 2 years ago, we had relatively few people leave, and last year we had a lot of people leave. I know that no one's surprised by that. Other questions? If not, I'm going to turn it over to our able CEO.
Well, I have to say, I think, it's good to hear the state of the school is strong. It's unfortunate that we don't have more distribution of students, because in my class, about a third of the class, I think, was from the U.S. or so, and a huge number of people did their training in the U.S., and I have to say, some of the smartest, best-trained people, present company excluded, in the U.S. hospitals are from McGill, and that's actually quite a brand down south. So it's hopefully at some point it will come back more. Okay, up to good stuff. Our first speaker was a victim of being nice, and I pulled her into a talk where she was volunteering for something else. Dr. Susan Kovacs, I'm going to introduce her. She did her undergrad in biology at Harvard before joining the class of 89. She did her pediatric training at Montreal Children's and did her pediatric gastroenterology training at Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto. And she has been there since, practicing in private practice as a pediatric gastroenterologist. She's a lecturer at the University of Toronto, as an on-staff at North York General Hospital, and of incredible significance is married to where is Steve Shadowitz? In his usual seat, Steve Shadowitz. They have three kids, I can't tell you how excited I am that you accepted to speak. And she's going to talk to us about celiac disease update in 2014. Susan, thank you. So.
Thank you.
want to use it, right? This is a pointer if you want to use it. Okay. Or you can use this as a pointer.
Oh, okay. Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much, Ramina and Ed, for hosting. Welcome, everybody. I thought I would speak about celiac disease because I thought it might be of general interest, and I'm a pediatric gastroenterologist in the community in Toronto, so it certainly affects my life quite a bit and my patients' lives. I have no disclosures, but as you can tell, the slides, the backbone of the slides come from NASPGHAN, which is the Organization for Pediatric Gastroenterologists for North America. Many of them have been changed the content, but they're a very good backbone. So one of the reasons why I think our patients often talk to us or ask us a lot of questions about this is it's always being talked about gluten and celiac disease in the media. So here's an article from this week's weekend's New York Times, and I don't know if anyone in the room also caught the South Park episode a couple of weekends ago entitled Gluten-Free Ebola. Amongst other things, it talked about body parts falling off with exposure to gluten and having to go into a gluten quarantine. That's how dangerous gluten can be. So we'll see about that. So it's a very general talk. I'm not an academic person, but I thought we'd spend a little bit of time talking about the basic science today, a lot about the clinical manifestations. Testing seems to be of great interest, and if there's time, talk about treatments. But there's quite a bit of time that I'm spending to talk a little bit about potential new treatments that might really change our practice. So the definition for celiac disease continues to get longer. I probably could have filled several slides about it, but it's something that keeps changing, especially in the 25 years since our class was together. But it's an immune-mediated enteropathy, so there's damage to the small intestine caused by a permanent sensitivity to gluten in genetically susceptible individuals. And what is being more and more appreciated is, yes, it causes symptoms, but they're not necessarily GI symptoms, and it doesn't always cause symptoms, and it's a lot of people who don't seem to understand that, and it's very important, probably the most important point in the talk. It's quite unique because we actually know how to fix it or fix it in most of our patients. If we eliminate gluten, it gets better. So here's a slide that would have changed very much if we'd been doing it 25 years ago or even 10 years ago about the prevalence of celiac disease in the world. It was thought once to be quite a rare disease, but it's not at all rare. In North America, it's about 1% of people. And there's a tribe in sub-Saharan Africa where it's 1 in 18, which is extraordinary. But it exists all over the world, not just in some populations. Sweden is a hotbed, which is interesting, and part of why that's true, especially recently, is they had an epidemic of celiac disease in the late 80s and 90s. And it's not exactly clear why that is. There are suspicions why. There were changes in feeding practices, earlier gluten, later gluten was thought, more breastfeeding, less breastfeeding. And there have been multi-center trials trying to tease this out, why it's true. And so far, there's no answer. There's a publication this month in the New England Journal, a multi-center trial in Europe trying to tease out this feeding issue. But so far, no one can prove exactly what's been going on. There's been some thoughts about could there be viral homologies to the gluten molecule, and most recently people are talking about rotavirus, but so far it's not very clear what's going on. Why is the prevalence so much greater than it used to be? It's doubled in the last 20 years. So good old gluten, here's the diagram that actually, if you watch closely, was in the South Park episode. I got a big kick out of that. So they also talked about how nonsensical this was, but this is actually true. So gluten is the protein component of wheat, and there are different fractions that we hear about, the alcohol-insoluble one, the alcohol-soluble one, gliadin, glutenin. What's interesting about this molecule is it's very, very hard to digest for humans in the normal state. We just can't break it down, so it ends up being still a large molecule as you're still trying to digest it. And it turns out that's because of the amino acid sequence, and it's very rich in proline and glutamine. The tissue transglutaminase enzyme is something that exists normally, and we use it for diagnostic purposes, but it's a normal enzyme in enterocytes. But when it gets released into the extracellular space, it starts to cross-link proteins. And in the case of gluten, it starts to deamidate it. And that turns out to be important, at least in part of the pathophysiology of the disease. It makes it more negatively charged and more likely to bind to the antigen-presenting cells that eventually will contribute to the damage. So a lot of the work that's been done in the last few years has been on the genetics of celiac disease. It was known for a very long time that first-degree relatives are much more effective than other people, but it wasn't just a genetic issue. And one of the markers that's now being used clinically is the HLA types. So it turns out that 95% of patients with celiac disease are actually HLA-DQ2 positive. So what this is, it's a protein-binding receptor on surface antigen-presenting cells. It starts the inflammatory cascade that's associated with celiac disease, but it's not very well worked out. Most patients have it. However, just because you have it, it doesn't mean you're going to get celiac disease, because as many as 40% of patients who don't have celiac disease are also HLA-DQ2 positive. The rest of the patients, almost all of them, are another type, HLA-DQ8 positive. So it turns out that these are necessary but not sufficient genes. There are many other genes that have been linked to celiac disease. They represent more of the genetic risk than these genes themselves, and most of those other genes have to do in various ways with the immune reaction. So here's a summary diagram of what is known so far. Some of the things that are known, it's a cartoon from a Scientific American article from not too long ago, and it talks about many of the things that I've mentioned already. There's also some work about tight junctions loosening, and that seems to let, this is the gluten molecule that's going through, getting into the lamina propria space. And here's their diagram, the diagram mentioning the tissue transglutaminase antibody deamidating that gluten, making it more likely to bind to the antigen-presenting cells. And so all these different steps are ideas that people are starting to have and implement about the treatment for celiac disease that would be different than a gluten-free diet. And so here are the potential therapies that so far aren't ready to put in a bottle and give to our patients, but they're probably going to be asking us about very soon. And the ones that are starred in the summary slide, they're actually undergoing clinical trials. So surprisingly, patients aren't so much trusting, just change the grain. But if you could change the genes of the wheat and the other grains themselves, maybe they'd make something different in their gluten that wouldn't be quite so toxic. But there's lots of interest in having enzymes, glutenases, that cut the gluten in a different way that, again, might not be so toxic. You could bind the gluten with polymers. You could vaccinate against the gluten or against the binding molecules, the HLA-DQ2 and DQ8 epitopes. There's some idea of using biologic because many of the inflammatory mediators are elevated. That's very, very preliminary. There's no study yet on a tissue transglutaminase antagonist, but there are thoughts about that. And then there's some work on using zonulin antagonist to tighten up the tight junctions. So I hope some of it works out, but nothing's ready yet. This is probably, the rest of the talk is going to be very familiar to many people in the room, but I just thought it was worthwhile to remind people, what does celiac look like when you see a patient? So when we went to medical school in our class, really we only talked about typical celiac disease, or almost that's all we talked about. So that's the gastrointestinal symptoms. But it turns out more and more patients, in fact, more patients present with so-called, apparently the term atypical is now frowned upon, which makes sense, non-classical presentations. Actually, most patients are asymptomatic. So here's the classic pediatric exam question. What does this child have? You know, here's a young child who's failing to thrive, and it was usually celiac disease was the answer that they were looking for. So here's a child with GI manifestations of celiac disease, causing wasting, probably malabsorbing, having diarrhea. And this is actually becoming quite a rare presentation. Much more common is the so-called non-GI manifestations, some of which are, here's an example of the rash of dermatitis herpetiformis, which essentially always is a patient who also has celiac disease virtually 100% of the time, rare in pediatrics, which is what I do. Some dental issues. Bony issues are a very big deal for adult medicine. Growth issues are a big issue in pediatrics. Fertility has become clear to be associated with it, rather infertility problems. Iron deficiency anemia, hepatitis, and many neurological issues. Many of these are secondary to vitamin deficiencies, but not all of them seem to be. It's not completely explained, but there's a lot of research that it seems to come in fits and starts. Something seems to be shown, and then something seems to be contradicted, which is why I'm not presenting it. So this is, I think, an important concept to remember for most people who want to identify celiac disease. The symptomatic patients that I've mentioned represent a tiny fraction of actual people who have the disease. So on the side here, this is the group that actually has celiac disease here and now. They have pathology that I'll talk about in a second that represents celiac disease. But most of these patients don't yet present with symptoms. A lot of people think they have celiac disease and don't, which is another issue. But we're missing a lot of patients. The bottom of this so-called celiac iceberg, here we are underwater, is not just silence, it's latent celiacs who have genetic potentials, who have these genes and probably other genes as well that are making them susceptible to celiac disease. But they even have positive serology, so they're probably on the way to getting celiac disease. But if you would do a biopsy, they don't have it yet. And this is a group that isn't as well studied yet as it should be. But so far, there's no evidence that they have an elevated cancer risk, which is one of the things that we worry about for celiac disease in the long term. A lot of this unrecognized asymptomatic group is represented by this slide here. So in pediatrics, we often have genetic syndromes that we think about, and some of those, especially Down's, may have celiac disease. And they, of course, might not be able to identify their symptoms. IgA deficiency is an important group because it is overrepresented in celiac, but it affects our ability to diagnose because some of our serologic testing is IgA-based. And then there's this large group of associated autoimmune conditions, type 1 diabetes being the most common, and liver disease being almost as common. And there's some things that are newly being recognized, especially EoE. That's a fairly recent recognition that it's associated. The increased malignancy risk is a very important point. It's something that's good to remind our patients about. I think that's the thing that I focus the most on when I try to get my patients to comply with a gluten-free diet. So the most well-known and devastating malignancy associated with it is this T-cell non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Sometimes patients present with this, but they've had celiac disease undiagnosed for years. So the idea that symptoms don't necessarily associate with increased malignancy risk isn't necessarily true. But it's a very, very aggressive, deadly malignancy, and it's at least 20 times increased in celiac disease. It seems to have a decreased risk if you go on a gluten-free diet, and there's been some recent work about actually if you can cause the villi to heal, if you can have a normal intestinal mucosa, you're probably going to, not surprisingly, decrease your risk of malignancy. There are other GI cancers that are associated with it. It's not nearly as common, but the number of malignancies and the number of associated deaths due to celiac disease was probably overrepresented in the past due to biases in the way the data was being presented. More recently, as they're looking in Scandinavia and other places for population-based information, there's not nearly as high a mortality or as high as a malignancy risk as was once thought. So how do you diagnose celiac disease? I think this room obviously knows how, but it was just worth emphasizing that you've got to be on the gluten-free diet. And I know the room knows, but our patients don't seem to know, and it's become very, very complicated to make a proper diagnosis of celiac disease for gastroenterologists. So a lot of people, sort of in a faddish way, are going gluten-free, and that makes it very difficult to make the diagnosis of celiac disease. the tissue transglutaminase antibody, so the antibody to this enzyme that seems to be important, at least in part, to the pathophysiology, is the main way that we at least start to screen our patients for celiac disease. So most of the assays that are available are IgA-based, a problem if you're IgA-deficient. But if patients screen high for this, usually that's going to turn out to mean that they have celiac disease. However, some of our patients come back serology negative. So what does it mean? Well, obviously it means they don't have celiac disease, but because of people going on low-gluten diets, it might be a false negative, and that's always a very, very important point to remember. And then, of course, I don't know if I can go back or not. No. I'm not sure. Huh? Help. Okay. Thank you. Sometimes it's a silly reason, just in the real world, sometimes tubes get mixed up, obviously. So if you're very suspicious, just repeat it. Sometimes people are quite resistant to do it. Unfortunately, at least in Ontario, but I think in most of Canada, this is a test that costs money, and there's some patients who can't afford it, unfortunately. It can be quite expensive in certain labs. If you've got a low titer positive patient, and the patient is very, very convinced that they might have celiac disease, a gluten challenge may become important. The gluten challenge is a very confusing topic because it isn't actually standardized. So when people ask me what's the right gluten challenge, my answer is as much gluten as you possibly can for as long as you possibly can, which I know doesn't sound very scientific, but actually that's probably the best answer. But in the real world, we have to tell them something. So there's some work where there's quite a bit of work, actually, especially in adult medicine, not so much in pediatrics, that if you have gluten for 6 weeks, and it has to be a lot of gluten, and depending on who you ask, what's a lot of gluten? So the Europeans talk about 6 pieces of bread per day, which to me just sounds bizarre, but some people say 2 to 4 pieces of bread, or the equivalent quantity of gluten. So if someone like me is looking for celiac disease with endoscopy, we see this is a pretty typical picture of scalloped mucosa, which is quite featureless. And under the microscope, they're looking for a pathology that this micrograph emphasizes lots of inflammatory infiltrate in the lamina propria and a loss of the normal villi. And this is referred to as Dr. Marsh 3 type lesion. So usually, this is the patient, this pathology is that patient that I showed you a picture of, that very sick 1.5-year-old child who's failing to thrive, who doesn't exist so often anymore. More and more of our patients are getting younger, having non-GI symptoms, and the pathology looks like this, far less specific. So it can be quite a problem to be sure that they have celiac disease and do they have to embark on a lifelong gluten-free diet, which, of course, is the treatment. Lately in Europe, there's been a push, especially in Europe, to not put children, especially through biopsies, for the diagnosis of celiac disease. I understand it's quite controversial in the States. So the adult GI people aren't very happy about this, is what I'm told. But it's becoming more accepted all over the world. And the idea from this ESPGAN criteria is that many studies showed that if you had a very high serology, a very high titer, it was very rare that you would have you'd have patients who don't actually have celiac disease if they have symptoms. So taking advantage of this fact, they came up with some very stringent criteria. If you want to diagnose someone with celiac disease without doing a biopsy, they have to have clear symptoms, unequivocal symptoms. They have to have very high titer serology. And just in case the tube got mixed up, do it again on a different day. Maybe use one of the other serologic tests, and for good measure, why don't you throw in the genetic test too? So some patients would rather have the biopsy, I think, but this is a conversation that I'm having in my office quite often. We don't necessarily have to do endoscopy. Those HLA type HLA-DQ2 typing, it's a very useful test if someone's not on a gluten-free diet, because you don't have to be on gluten for the test to be reasonable. However, it can never rule in celiac disease. It can only rule it out. I guess the last thing that I'll say is, obviously, the treatment is a lifelong gluten-free diet, and I think of it as learning a new language. I used to tell people, walk around with a little book, with a little guide, and people now laugh at me when I say that. They have apps, of course, on every phone for this. There's dozens of apps available of different quality. And, you know, the devil's really in the details, because, of course, you've got to avoid wheat, barley, and rye, but there are other things that you have to avoid, and who knows where these things are hiding, including in Play-Doh and in makeup, especially in lipstick. You don't want to swallow it. And licking envelopes. Celiac disease is confirmed only, especially in a child, if they grow, or in an adult, if they stop losing weight, if that's what they were doing, if their symptoms resolve, and if the serology normalizes. So these patients, although most of them are quite well, need follow-up. We need to do their serology every year to make sure they're not making mistakes or cheating. So I hope everyone isn't so afraid of gluten that you have to cut it out, because it's not really as scary as it was. But there is this entity called gluten sensitivity that everyone seems to think they have. For example, about 5% of Australian adults are on a gluten-free diet just because they think it makes them better. So most researchers in this field are quite skeptical that this actually exists. It probably does exist, but it doesn't exist as commonly as people say. So basically, gluten sensitivity is someone who has symptoms that could very well be celiac disease or wheat allergy even, but when you test them, there's no documentation that any of that is possible. There's nothing wrong with going gluten-free. It can be a very nutritious diet, but they don't have to follow it nearly as carefully as they do if they actually have celiac disease, because celiac disease patients do get sick from their gluten. So thank you for your attention. It's great to be back in Montreal.
Thank you, Susie. Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to finish the first three talks, and then we'll open for some questions. Our next speaker is Ron Baldessari. Ron is the clinical assistant professor at the University of British Columbia and division head of ophthalmology at Kelowna General Hospital. Ron is a native Montrealer. He pursued ophthalmology training at McGill, followed by a fellowship in cornea, external disease, and refractive surgery. Who knew there were such detailed fellowship programs? And he did that at Emory in Atlanta. In 1995, he moved to Kelowna, British Columbia, to begin his private practice, and in 1996, established a corneal transplant service for the BC Interior, where his focus remains anterior reconstructive procedures of the eye. He's currently the division head of ophthalmology at Kelowna General Hospital and is a clinical assistant professor at the University of British Columbia, as I mentioned. In his spare time, and there seems to be not very much of, in his spare time he enjoys hockey, biking, and skiing with his family, in addition to triathlon, competing internationally as a member of Team Canada at World Age Group Championships. I tried for the over 90s, and I couldn't make it, right? At the Group A Championships in Budapest, Hungary in 2010, and in Auckland, New Zealand in 2012. Thank you very much for agreeing to speak.
Thank you. So bear with me with my technical issues, because I have a new computer, and I know that some of the funds we raised last night, that's okay, I'll take care of it. Okay. We're going to go towards a new AV setup here. Okay, so slideshow. F5? Perfect. Okay. So what I'd like to talk about is advances in corneal transplantation techniques, because when I graduated from McGill, and even after my fellowship, there's been a real transformation in how we do corneal transplants. We've gone from the standard penetrating keratoplasty into more specific lamellar procedures, and we love our acronyms, so we have DSEC, DALC, and DMEC. And then if we have enough time, I'll present a case of limbal stem cell transplantation, which is something that combines some of the techniques. We get made fun of a lot, and We have to go over the anatomy, and one of the reasons that people make fun of us is that after years and years of studying, you see that red layer, the dual layer? Apparently we missed one. So this is a proposed new layer of the cornea, but we basically have the five layers as they used to be, the epithelium, the stroma, which is very acellular, and those are the main structures. And then obviously the Bowman's and decimates. Decimates down here on the interior, and the endothelium. Now, the endothelium is a layer that you're born with, about 4,000 cells per square millimeter, and there's a gradual attrition as you age. Its function is to pump fluid out of the stroma, which is spongy and always wants to imbibe water. So if you lose your endothelial cells down to less than 800 cells per square millimeter, your cornea will start to swell, and that's when you lose optical clarity. And that's important for a lot of the corneal endothelial diseases that we'll talk about, one of them being Fuchs. Now, the cornea's main function is really to focus light. It's the strongest lens of the eye, accounts for about two-thirds of the total power. And obviously, if it gets scarred or opaque, you have poor vision. So this is an example here of Fuchs dystrophy, where we have a lot of corneal edema. It's very obvious. If we look with a slit lamp, we could see this kind of beaten metal appearance to the endothelium. That's the reflection off the endothelium. And here a specular micrograph shows, you know, the normal hexagonal cells are a different size and different shapes. And we have these big dark areas, which are guttata. Those are areas where there's no endothelial cells. That's the hallmark of the disease. So we do corneal transplants for various indications, the most common being optical, from scars, swelling, irregularity of shape. We can also do it because we need structural support. That would be a tectonic graft. Here's an example of one of our finer citizens of Kelowna that got into an issue with somebody who had a broken beer bottle and took out part of his cornea. So you couldn't suture this primarily because there was just a big chunk of his cornea missing. And this is actually a technique that the late Don Boyanner taught us. If you don't have banked sclera to use, you can actually take sclera from the patient. So what I did was fashioned a half-thickness flap, folded it over, sutured it in place, and that's what sealed the hole. So we can do them for tectonic reasons, for trauma. We can also do them for infections. Here's an example of a contact lens abuser who had a big pseudomonas ulcer, and sometimes if it progresses to thinning, you just have to do a transplant because it's going to basically pop. Here's another example of an infection that's impossible to control with standard antibiotics or antifungals because that's a fungal infection. We can also do transplants because we have cosmetic issues. We have patients who are born with dermoid cysts, other types of hamartomas, and this is a 17-year-old girl, but by the time she became 17, people started noticing, and she became very, very self-aware of this lesion. And so what you do is you excise this, which goes deep into the sclera and the cornea, and then you fashion a transplant, which is half cornea, half sclera, thin it out to the same depth as what you took off freehand, and then suture it in. So, you know, 6 weeks later, you really can't tell that she's had a procedure. Now, the first corneal transplant that was successful was done in 1905 by Edward Zerm in the Czech Republic. What's interesting to note is that his clinic performed 47,000 transplants, you know, over his career, but very, very few were successful, but they kept trying. Gotta give him credit for trying. What's interesting, I mean, you think about it, they used general anesthesia. I don't know what kind of alcohol or whatever they had, but they used some form of general anesthesia. They had no sutures, they had no steroids, they had no microscope, but they did have a 5 millimeter circular trephine. The way that they did it was they had a donor tissue, and this guy was actually well ahead of his time because he kept the tissue moist and aseptic. They decided not to use any kind of antiseptics which would have killed the endothelium. They didn't really understand what the purpose of the endothelium was, but he did everything that was correct to preserve that tissue, and then they just strung the conjunctival epithelium over the graft in the periphery to hold it in place. And it was same size, so obviously there's anatomical things. If you cut with the same size trephine, you're always going to undercut your graft. So God love them for actually figuring it out and making one of them work. I guess that's why they did 47,000 afterwards. So nowadays, things haven't changed that much for penetrating keratoplasty. We still use a circular tree fine. There's many different types. And we cut it, we oversize it by about a quarter to a half. We secure it with 10-0 or 11-0 nylon. Here's an example of a running suture. You can do them running or interrupted. And then we remove the stitches at about 6 to 18 months later, depending on the patient's age, because young patients heal faster, the sutures get loose, and so on. Now, it was the most common procedure done up until about 2006. And one of the drawbacks of this procedure is that you're replacing the entire cornea despite the layer that's diseased. So you're taking off good, healthy tissue simply because you have no other means of replacing the diseased part. And it is successful 95% of the time, meaning that the cornea will remain clear in the patient's eye. But there are some things that we need to consider. It's an open sky procedure, basically meaning that if you have, once you've taken off the donor, or I should say the host button, the diseased tissue, you have an open globe. And these patients are awake. Anesthesia sometimes is not perfect as far as they're freezing. If they move, cough, or happen to be obese, where there's a lot of positive intrathoracic pressure, the ocular contents have a way of wanting to leave the eye. And you can't just put it back. So if that happens, goodbye. They're blind. So, you know, we talked about replacing the healthy and diseased layers. But in addition, there's a long rehab to graft clarity. It takes about 6 months for the grafts to start to clear up, sometimes up to a year. You can get suture infections and the 5 o'clock Friday afternoon suture breakage when nobody's on or around. And so even if you do everything perfectly, sometimes your vision is limited by the high degree of astigmatism. So sometimes they have, you know, 8 diopters of astigmatism, and you have to try to fix that so you can get them in glasses or contacts. And then you even have to worry about graft dehiscence, because even if you take the stitches out 2 years later and everything looks fine, they rub their eye and boom, they open the wound. So in 1998, Garrett Mellis, who's in Europe, proposed, why don't we try layer-specific surgery? So if the endothelium is damaged, let's just replace the endothelium. Let's leave the corneal stroma and the epithelium because it's healthy. And the evolution of that has led to these three techniques, going from anterior to posterior. DALC, which is deep anterior lamellar keratoplasty. DSEC, which is decemase stripping automated endothelial keratoplasty, and then DMEC, which is decemase membrane endothelial keratoplasty. So in DALC, what we're trying to do is we want to replace everything but decemase and the endothelium. Great idea. We simply take out any kind of scar, we leave the endothelium, and the main reason for wanting to leave the endothelium is because that's where we get most of our rejection. Even though the cornea is an immunologically privileged site in the sense that there's no vascularization, the number of antigens are highest from the endothelium, and that's where we get rejection. So if you can leave that layer, and the patient has their own endothelium, they're much less likely to reject. So we talked about taking out only the diseased part. We leave the endothelium, less rejection, and then less risk of an expulsive hemorrhage from a cough or a sneeze during surgery because you still have that layer sitting there not open to the environment. The disadvantage is that there's a high rate of intraoperative complications and that the vision is usually at least one line less than a successful PK. 10% require a conversion to a full-thickness transplant because, remember, we've got 50 microns that we're dealing with. It's a very thin area to avoid penetrating. And if you leave any kind of tissue, you know, some of the keratocytes, if you leave them from the host, they will metaplase into fibroblasts, and then you'll get scarring at the interface, and then the vision goes to hell. Okay, so now here's where we get a tricky, because I have to try to figure out how to get my videos working, but I think we've got it. So this is DALC. Here what we're doing is using a tree fine to go down about 250 microns. So these are preset with a depth gauge. You go down about 250 microns, and then what we'll do is take a needle, go into the stroma, but we don't want to enter the eye. That would be an instant conversion at that point. And we're going to inject air, and what that air is going to do is going to travel through the stroma, which is spongy, and then detach decemase and push it posteriorly away from us, because we want decemase to be deep into the anterior chamber. So you inject, 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 boom, it turns white, all the air is in there. Okay, great. Now let's take off half of the cornea that we've done. So now we'll unroof this area, and then make an incision. You'll see with a knife. Now, you want to make that incision, but you don't want to go through decimates, and it's a blind procedure. We all ophthalmologists like that term, a blind procedure. So, and whoever says oops has to buy lunch because the patient's awake. So now, here we have decimates. There's about 50 micron. We're going to take a blunt instrument, make sure there's no nicks on it, make sure that CSR hasn't mangled it. And with a blade, we will now cut any kind of overlying fiber in four quadrants. So then we'll pass that inferiorly and nasally and temporally, and you can see with a flat blade, just cut through that so that we have basically four leaflets. And once we have the four leaflets, we'll take blunt tip scissors, because you don't want to use anything sharp, and then we can dissect and cut those quadrants out. What's really neat is, I mean, these are three techniques that I'm showing that we had no clue were going to exist when you finish. You felt like you're going to do the same thing for the rest of your life. So here now we'll strip decimates. It comes off quite easily from the donor tissue. And if you're in a place with an eye bank, you can actually potentially use that tissue in one of the procedures that I'm going to explain in the future. So now stripping decimates off, and then you simply sew it in. Yeah. After a while, it does get simple. That's what I always say, that with transplants, the easy part is the surgery. The hard part is the post-op. Okay, so I'm down here, I guess. Yes. F5.
No.
Oh.
Not F5.
How do I get back next time? Keep going down. Okay. What do I hit next time so that I don't do that?
Yeah, click on.
Okay, escape? Okay. All right. So, DALK is great, but there's a potential waste of good tissue because, you know, you need to have something that has a good endothelium to transplant, because not all tissue is adequate for transplantation because the endothelial cell count isn't high enough. So you potentially could waste tissue because you have to peel that strip off, and then now it's a full thickness. Okay, that tissue is in the garbage now. So now I've got to get a new tissue. The flip side is that you could potentially do two transplants if you're successful, because you could do DALK on one side and a DMEC on the other. I mean, a different patient. But so because of this, it's not as frequently performed because there's a very high, steep learning curve. And I think we need to have some technical improvements so that we can do this more reliably without having to convert. DISSEC, on the other hand, has become the predominant form of treating endothelial disease, where the stroma and the epithelium and the remaining anterior segment is fine. It was zero cases in 2002, and in BC it's 90% of the cases in 2012. So it's much faster rehab. These patients are seeing to their maximum in 3 months instead of 12 to 18. We only have three sutures to deal with, and none of these sutures are actually in the graft. So we don't have to worry about doing anything to the graft. These are simply sutures to close the wounds that we've made to perform our surgery. That we don't have any suture-related complications because those sutures are removed at about 4 to 6 weeks. We don't have any induced astigmatism. The patient keeps the same kind of glasses that they've always had. And we can do surgery, cataract surgery, in a controlled environment, meaning a closed system like we do with phacoemulsification. And it's not an open sky, so it's much more reliable, much safer, and then it saves them to have a second operation, which would damage more endothelial cells, which is what we're trying to avoid in the first place. So what's the con? Technically, it's a little bit more uncontrolled because you aren't actually ever suturing that graft into place. You're using the osmotic force of the endothelial cells to make that graft stick to the posterior stroma. There's a higher primary failures, about 2 to 4%, usually because the graft detaches. And the graft can detach most commonly on the first day post-op 1, but it can do it late, 2 to 3 weeks later. The vision's almost as good. Most patients would trade, 20/25 vision for faster rehab and no significant astigmatism and greater comfort than going for 20/20 in a year and a half. Okay, so escape. Now, here.
Eye scoring of decimates membrane is easily seen, followed by strip.
There we go. Okay, so here we have a patient where we've marked the endothelium, Okay, this is going to be the size of our graft, and we simply strip the endothelium. So basically, we've scored it all the way around with a blunt probe. You don't want to go into the stroma. You just simply want to break decimase free. And then you simply peel it towards the center and then pull it out. And if they have a lot of guttata, all those guttata, which are optically significant, because even if you have a full complement of endothelial cells, those guttata, it's like having pebbles. And you just can't see clearly. Their contrast vision is quite poor. So now that tissue has been pulled out. And there it is, matching the size, just to show you. And then the eye bank will pre-cut the tissue. What they'll do is they'll take a microkeratome and make a cap of a fixed depth onto the donor tissue, okay? So that we've got a cut down to about 300 microns, a planar cut through the entire donor tissue. So that's what we do. And here, we had scored the stroma in the periphery so that it has something to adhere a little bit better. So there's the donor tissue. The cap is on it. And now we'll do a full thickness cut with our circular trephine. And so now we're going through the two layers so that you can see it's a circular centered cut. And I'll peel the donor tissue off of the anterior part. So I'm going to take... Basically, what we're using this for is a scaffold to hold our endothelium. So that's about 100 microns thick. And those forceps, they don't actually join together because that would crush the tissue and lead to endothelial cell loss. So they come together at about 100 microns, and then you slide it in like a folded taco. It's true. Okay, so you kind of nudge it into place, and I don't know if you can tell, but right here, this edge is more to the left than the interior edge, and that allows us to get an air bubble between the two and then unfold the flap. So now your taco is open, and you simply raise the pressure, and then it will stick automatically once those endothelial cells start to pump fluid. And then you can just wipe away the interface... fluid, you can see there's stitches there to close the wound, and then you remove the air, but you leave about an 8 millimeter air bubble in place with the patient lying on their back for the next hour so that the graft will take. No, I don't want to do that. And that's what it looks like about a month later. 2 minutes. I mean, you're not going to talk. So this is what it looks like afterwards. And you can see here on a slit lamp, there is the little edge. So it's an additive tissue, so it's sitting there on the back. And it accounts for 90% of the transplants that we do. I should say dollars, but there's a lifetime cost savings, actually. It's one of the few procedures where it actually costs the system less to do this than to do a full-thickness transplant if you look at it over the lifetime of the patient. It greatly simplifies our post-operative care and greater patient satisfaction. Now, DMEC is an evolution of this where you're replacing only decimase and the endothelium. It's most challenging because I want to show you how... wild this one is. This one you need... This one you need some chutzpah to do with, as they say. Where is it? That one? Okay, there we go. This one. So here, it's already been scored, and so we just took out the tissue the same way, and now... You can see it's curled up here. It's been peeled, and it wants to curl on its own. You can't see it if you just put it in the eye like that, so you have to stain it. You kind of bleed off the stain, and then grab the tissue, and then you put it in saline into a cartridge that we use normally for injecting lenses, and then it'll curl up. And then you very gently nudge it down this, which is kind of like a little micro pipette. And then you insert it in the eye. This is not me operating. This is Frank Price in the States, who does probably the most of these, him and maybe Terry well, Terry Kim and a bunch of others. But this is a nerve-wracking procedure because that tissue, when you inject it, can look like anything. And so it's very easy to put the endothelium, you know, the wrong way. And then, obviously, the patient's not going to see very well. And if you don't have enough or if you have too much pressure in here at the same time, it's easy for that tissue to shoot right out. So the first thing you do is close the incision so that nothing can leave. And then you got to just nudge it. Nudge it, hit it, tap it, spend an hour trying to get this thing to unfold properly. And then you use the same technique of putting a little tiny air bubble, and it's like you use it like a little ball bearing to kind of roll it back and forth to try to get that thing to open. So it is a very technically challenging procedure. The benefit is that that tissue is very, very uniform, and if you get it in the right position and it adheres, their vision is fantastic. It's often 20/20. Here we are. It's just, yeah. So anyhow, so that's DMACC. So again, a very challenging procedure. Okay, so I will show this just because this is a really interesting case. And this combines a couple of the techniques because the limbal stem cells are the cells that border the junction between the cornea and the conjunctiva, and they don't ever grow. So they will populate the cornea centrally, but they won't grow peripherally, so in the periphery. So if you lose them from injury, you basically get your entire cornea covered with conjunctiva, vascularized, non-optical conjunctiva. It's quite poor vision. And if we're taking it from the patient's other eye, we'll only do an autograft because if we take too much from the fellow eye, obviously we're going to cause that side to fail. You can do it as an allograft from donor tissue, but there's a high rate of rejection because you're putting vascularized tissue into vascularized tissue. It's very difficult. They have to be on immunosuppression, systemic immunosuppression. So I will finish up by going here and here, here. So this is what his eye looked like before. This eye, years back, would have been just lost. You wouldn't have been able to do anything with that. So you'd basically take off all the overlying scar and conjunctiva. You mark the periphery with a trephine because you want to have an arcuate free-handed graft. So we'll cut down to about 200 microns, take out two wedges like I showed before. We'll take out this out of the host. And the donor, we're going to keep the epithelium. So after we've done that, to show you, this is the graft here in position. This has both the conjunctiva, some sclera, and the cornea. It's sewn in. Here's where we took it from. And if we look here, after that heals, it's incredible to see what having normal corneal epithelium does. So this is just by taking off that tissue and putting on normal epithelium, the cornea heals, and then you can do a full thickness transplant. And then the final result is that this isn't playing. Let's see. Oh, well. You get the picture. So that's it in a nutshell for lamellar transplants, and that's how we've changed, and we don't do things nearly the same way as we did just 10 years ago. Thank you.
So if you have gory, gory, gory videos, you get extra time, right? That's how it works. Okay. Our next speaker, Dr. Iris Gorfinkel. You have that one? Okay. The title of her talk is Pitfalls in Clinical Research. Iris is a family practitioner who graduated with our class, was actually an OBGYN specialist in Vancouver, and where she did her first clinical trial, and I'm going to let you tell that story. I'm going to stay on the good side of this class. And then now, since she has her kids, she's been practicing as a family physician in Toronto, and she also founded and directs Prime Health Clinical Research, a private clinical research facility in which she has participated as principal investigator in over 50 phase 2 and phase 3 clinical trials in several areas of primary care for several major pharmaceutical companies. Thank you, Aris.
Thank you, Ramin. It is a great pleasure and honor to be presenting a retrospective on the pitfalls of clinical research. I just wanted to mention before I go into it that I owe so much to McGill, and as a proud alumnus, I stand before you 25 years later and would do the whole thing again if time were reversed. As one may well appreciate, I have numerous disclosures. This summarizes the many sponsors with whom I've worked over the past 12 years in numerous clinical research trials. It is through the lens of this experience, that I thought it appropriate to examine the history of clinical research with its many pitfalls and some of its glory along the way. Before I begin, there's a further disclosure I wish to make. While obvious, it still bears emphasis. What you are about to hear does not reflect the majority of medical research, but rather a very narrow selection of medical research that maintains its relevancy due to the major changes they prompted in the ways in which clinical research is conducted. I begin with two items of interest. One, a quotation from Friedrich Hegel, that the only thing we learn from history is that we learn nothing from history. Let's hope he's not altogether correct. This is a tough one to reconcile in clinical research, as historically researchers have rationalized and later defended actions based on two ostensibly complementary yet fundamentally competing interests. One, the interest of the patient, and two, the interest of society as a whole. The second item of interest is a painting. Paul Gauguin asks, where do we come from? What are we? And where are we going? This masterpiece was created at around the same time we began our retrospective in clinical research in 1897. The painting is read from right to left, with the three major figure groups illustrating the questions posed in the title. There's three women with a child represent the beginning of life. The middle group symbolizes the daily existence of young adulthood, and in the final group, according to the artist, an old woman approaching death appears reconciled and resigned to her thoughts. At her feet, a strange white bird represents the futility of words, and the blue idol in the background represents the beyond. Paul Gauguin first asks, where do we come from? In order to fully understand who we are, and before we can ask where are we going, this initial question sets the foundation. From the right, the three women with a child represent the beginning of life. And so we begin our journey. Remember the dilemma between patient interests versus societal interests. Our first guest is both a medical hero and what some Germans had called a criminal. This is Albert Neisser, the German physician who identified Neisseria gonorrhea. At the young age of 29 years, he was a dermatologist who was named Professor Extraordinarius. In his endeavor to discover a vaccine against syphilis, he injected cell-free serum from patients with syphilis into prostitutes who had been admitted for other conditions. There was clearly no informed consent, and even after a few patients took him to court, he had much support from his colleagues for this research. Albert Neisser had been guided by his conscience rather than any legal standard. The public wasn't convinced, and following much debate in Germany, the first set of guidelines was issued by the Reich government. These were surprisingly modern and included principles of beneficence and non-maleficence. That means doing no harm and doing better, patient autonomy, proxy consent, informed consent, written documentation, and structure for a suggested trial. The guidelines got it right, except for two small matters. One, it was based on a hierarchical model with the medical director responsible for all clinical research, and two, the guidelines were not binding. The first informed consent award actually goes to this man, Walter Reed, a U.S. Army physician who in 1901 led the team that postulated and confirmed the theory that yellow fever is transmitted by mosquitoes. This insight gave impetus to the new fields of epidemiology and biomedicine. It also allowed the resumption and completion of the work on the Panama Canal. In 1904, prior to this, huge numbers of workers had been succumbing to both malaria and yellow fever due to the large number of mosquitoes in the area. Here's a photograph of what is arguably the first informed consent, which was penned by Dr. Walter Reed. Now, to his credit, he states the purpose of the trial clearly enough, and I quote, to determine, quote, the method of transmission of yellow fever made upon his person, and that he endangers his life to a certain extent. True enough, but then the consent reads, being entirely impossible for you to avoid the infection during your stay on this island, you prefer to take the chance of contracting it intentionally in the belief that you will receive the most skillful of medical service. Now, there are numerous coercions in this consent, not the least of which is that it involved military personnel who are obviously have to take orders. It also erroneously informed participants that it was entirely impossible to avoid yellow fever if they did not participate. And in addition, in small letters here at the bottom, promises a huge sum of money, up to $200 in American gold, if yellow fever were contracted. While this seems rather egregious today, have a look at the background of ads at the time that were found in the media commonly. Stomach troubles vanished like magic. Blindness prevented and cured. Blindness. Cancer can be cured. And for localized treatment of female distress, cardioseptic. And don't forget, cocaine toothache drops for the kids. And cleansing digoxin. This wasn't just a matter of empty promises. There was a real threat of bodily harm. But it wasn't the digoxin nor the cocaine that spurred change, but rather Massengill's elixir sulfanilamide, suggested for the treatment of all conditions in which hemolytic streptococci appear. Harold Watkins, a chemist and pharmacist working alone, had simply tested for flavor, raspberry, appearance, and fragrance. And following this, 268 gallons of elixir sulfanilamide were distributed across the U.S. of A. The product was recalled following the deaths of over 100 patients, and Harold Watkins, the inventor and chemist and quasi-entrepreneur, committed suicide just prior to the time Massengill was to go out to trial. Congress responded to public outrage by passing the 1938 Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, which required companies to perform animal safety tests on their new proposed drugs and submit the data to the FDA before being allowed to product their markets. And the FDA was born. However, you will recall that back in Germany, the first set of systematic guidelines was not binding. In addition, there was a subtle shift in the attitude which had been the foundation of the euthanasia movement, that in fact there was such a thing as a life not worthy to be lived. Indeed, from 1933 to 1945, Nazi Germany carried out a campaign to cleanse German society of individuals viewed as biological threats to the nation's health. One Nazi government document explained, and to quote, in the case of plants and animals cultivated by humans, care is taken to weed out the less valuable. Once the useful and valuable genetic material is preserved, that is also what nature wants through the law of selection. Should we not do the same with people? The law of prevention of offspring with hereditary illness was decreed in Germany in 1933. Following this, 400,000 forced sterilizations and over 275,000 euthanasia deaths took place. This campaign was based in part on ideas about public health and in part on ideas of genetic fitness that had grown out of the Darwinian concepts of evolution to the problems of human society at the time. By 1942, almost 50% of doctors, numbering more than 38,000, joined the Nazi Party, attracted to research and research support and career opportunities, and ultimately, horrific experimentation was carried out using justification of racial cleansing and demonstrating so-called Jewish racial inferiority. The policy of mass extermination could not have possibly have been so effectively carried out during the active participation without the active participation of German medical scientists at the time. During World War II, painful and often deadly experiments were conducted on thousands of concentration camp prisoners without their consent. They were mainly Jews, including Jewish children, and in some cases, Romani, ethnic Poles, Soviet POWs, homosexuals, and disabled non-German Jews. Further lethal experimentation and war crimes were carried out in Unit 731 by Japanese personnel. Unlike their German counterparts, they were granted immunity in exchange for information. Leading German physicians who had participated and prompted the deadly human experimentation faced trial in Nuremberg in 1947 in what is known as the Doctor's Trial. Dr. Arthur Kaplan, author and editor of over 32 books and 600 papers in peer-reviewed journals of science, medicine, philosophy, bioethics, and health policy, was later to write, "The whole discipline of biomedical ethics rises from the ashes of the Holocaust." Dr. Kaplan was reflecting on the Nuremberg Code, a code which was surprisingly similar to those that had been drawn up in Germany earlier, unfortunately, including this also being non-binding. Which brings us to Paul Gauguin's next question. Who are we? And in 1948, the Hippocratic Oath was modernized in the Declaration of Geneva, a promise, an oath, again, non-binding, that every doctor in the world would make upon receiving a medical degree. However, back in the U.S. of A., trouble had been brewing. In 1932, the U.S. Public Health Service sought to study the natural progression of untreated syphilis in rural African-American men who were lured by a promise of last-chance opportunity to receive a very special examination and treatment by the health department. The study recruited 600 impoverished sharecroppers from Alabama, 399 black men with syphilis, and 210 black men who were uninfected. The men were given free medical care, meals, and free burial insurance for participating in the study. They were never told they had syphilis, nor were they treated for it. According to the Center for Disease Control, the men were told they were being treated for bad blood. Here's a man being screened for neurosyphilis, again, without consent, and with the belief that he's receiving a, quote, last chance for special treatment. By 1944, penicillin had become the standard treatment for syphilis. However, scientists continued the study without treating any of the participants. Indeed, many patients were lied to about having been provided treatment and were given sham treatments just for the purpose of researchers observing the full, long-term progression of the disease. Decades passed while the numbers of victims increased. Shown as a Depression-era poster advocating early syphilis treatment, still, no one had reevaluated the protocols of the so-called Tuskegee study according to the new standards of the Nuremberg Code, which was non-binding. At this time, at the same time in which Federal Public Health Service in the U.S. would rationalize withholding treatment against syphilis, a cornerstone document was created in Helsinki by the World Medical Association. This was called the Declaration of Helsinki, created in 1964, specifically addressed clinical research asserting that the investigating physician's duty is solely to the patient and not to the society in which the physician resides. This is the first significant effort of the medical community to regulate research itself and forms the basis of most subsequent documents. This document was heralded to be the property of all humankind, and yet it too was non-binding according to international law. But all this was about to change with this man. In 1966, Henry K. Beecher, an anesthetist-in-chief at Harvard, published an article in the New England Journal citing 22 examples of egregious, unethical practices in premier U.S. institutions, and for this, he was severely criticized by his colleagues. As unfair a generalization as it may have been, Dr. Beecher laid the foundation for current guidelines. In the same year, a 27-year-old Peter Buxton, who was a venereal disease investigator at the Public Health Service in San Francisco, had sent a letter to the national director of the Division of Venereal Diseases to express his concern about the ethics of the ongoing Tuskegee study. This letter was completely disregarded. The following year, Buxton left the Public Health Service to head for law school. And the story broke in the Washington Star in 1972. Think about how late that is, 1972. And then in the New York Times. And the following day, Senator Edward Kennedy called congressional hearings at which Buxton testified. The so-called ad hoc Tuskegee Syphilis Study Advisory Panel officially terminated the study in 1972. 3 months after the story broke. Victims included 128 men who died of syphilis and related complications, 40 of their wives who had contracted the disease, and 19 of their children born with congenital syphilis, all of whom were untreated. In 1974, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare was born to ensure that such experiments would never again be conducted. This created the National Research Act, which created, finally, mandatory guidelines, 1974, mandatory guidelines for human subject research and oversaw and regulated the use of human experimentation in medicine. This act created the National Commission for the Protection of Human Service Subjects of Biomedical and Behavioral Research, which in turn, 5 years later, wrote the Belmont Report. This is a report which summarizes ethical principles and guidelines for research involving human subjects. Three core principles are identified: respect for persons, beneficence, and justice. Autonomy means respect for persons in the form of informed consent and the voluntary nature of clinical research. Beneficence means that research should maximize benefit and minimize harm. And justice within the study is served when there are fair procedures and outcomes in the selection of research subjects. One decade following this, the concept of a world standard approach to clinical safety trial efficacy was discussed in Paris at the World Health Organizational meeting. Representatives from regulatory agencies and industry associations of Europe, Japan, and the U.S. met one year later, and the International Clinical Harmonization's good clinical practices were drafted. This is now the standard, which has been adopted into law in over 40 countries and counting. ICH defines standards that governments then transpose into regulations for clinical trials involving human subjects. So this is essentially how multinational trials are conducted. The ICH GCP guidelines is what sets a standard of care for, it's over 40 countries now that follow this, so we're all doing the same things the same way. Countries may use these guidelines, but the guidelines themselves are optional. They draft them into law. Which brings us to the final and most difficult of questions. Where are we going? And could it be that with legalized euthanasia, We are actually taking a step back in time despite our currently evolved definition of good clinical practices. In order to answer this question, I've invited Dr. Margaret Somerville, sorry, Professor Margaret Somerville, who holds professorship in both Faculty of Law and the Faculty of Medicine. She was the founding director of McGill Center for Medicine, Ethics and Law. She plays an active role in the development of applied ethics, in particular the study of wider ethical and legal aspects of medicine and science. Professor Somerville is a speaker, consultant, and researcher on topics such as euthanasia, reproductive technologies, mental health, human rights and healthcare, the pharmaceutical industry, AIDS, abortion, and the role that scientific and medical research and technology play in the formation of societal values. She is the author of the numerous papers and also The Ethical Canary, Science, Society, and the Human Spirit, and Death Talk, the Case of Against Euthanasia and Physician-Assisted Suicide. She's earned numerous distinctions, including an Order of Australia. All this in addition to having taught us the class of 89. I welcome Professor Somerville just for a five-minute talk.
Thank you, and it's nice to be back with the class of 89. We would have been in this same room, and I'm sure when you were hearing about ethics. I'll be very brief. Iris asked me to come to say, well, is there anything similar happening today that we can see those abuses? There's been a lot written on, particularly with the relation to the Nazi doctors. How did those good, extremely highly educated research doctors get into this? How did the people do that and not be aware that it was wrong in relation to the Tuskegee experiments? And is what might be happening today that could be similar? And I think what you see is that those doctors got swept along. They got caught up in what was happening. They didn't perceive the ethics of what they were doing. We've got new research that tells us that you have to have intact emotional centres in your brain, and you have to exercise moral intuition and not just reason in the sense of logical cognitive thinking to have a properly rounded ethical decision. And I think that those people, they thought they were doing good. There's an old saying in human rights that nowhere are human rights more threatened than when we act purporting to do only good. Because what that does, that makes us numb to the harms that are also necessarily involved. And I think that's happening with assisted suicide and euthanasia at the moment. And I think as physicians, you are the main people who can do something about preventing that. You've got to insist that people take the white coat off what is going on there, namely helping people to kill themselves, assisted suicide, or killing the patient with a lethal injection. And I think you will have a tremendous impact if you do that. For the Canadian physicians here, it's a total disgrace, I believe, what the Canadian Medical Association has just done, in that they have gone to what they call a neutral stance about euthanasia, but it's not. You can't have a neutral stance on euthanasia. There's no mushy middle. If you're not against euthanasia, you're for it. And in the factum that they put into the Supreme Court of Canada this last Wednesday in the Carter case, where we've got a case where the Supreme Court is going to decide whether it is unconstitutional to prohibit assisted suicide, the Canadian Medical Association said even if palliative care was not available, then euthanasia should still be provided to patients who want it. And so that's how far this has gone. Just a short story. The language is important here. In this new Quebec Act that we've got, the word euthanasia is never mentioned. That act will come into effect early next year, and it's called medically assisted death. Well, we all want medical assistance when we're dying, but that doesn't mean we want to be killed. So I was lecturing, actually, in Australia to the Australian Medical Association. There were about 600 physicians present, and I was getting very worked up about this and saying, look, you're all doctors, you must not do this, and you've got to stand up and speak out against it. And I sort of thumped the desk and said, we can't have doctors killing patients for a whole lot of reasons, both the doctor's reasons and the patient's reasons. Anyway, one of my friends and colleagues who unusually as a palliative care physician supports euthanasia, he jumped up from the back of this big audience and he yelled out, he said, Margot, would you stop using that word killing? And I said, well, what should I use? If it's not killing, what is it? He said, it's VAE. And I said, well, what's VAE? And he said, well, it's voluntary act of euthanasia. So we even use a nice acronym. It makes it sound much less offensive. Anyway, later in the speech, I said, well, if we're going to have this, we can't have doctors doing it. And it's not too difficult to train somebody else to be able to give a lethal injection. So the question was, who should those other people be? Well, what do you need? You need somebody who understands the law and knows how to apply it strictly. That's why we want this law to be applied strictly. And so the answer to that is the people trained to do that are lawyers. So we should have a specially trained group of lawyers. And with that, my friend jumped up in the back of the audience and screamed out, Margot, are you crazy? You'd have lawyers killing people? Thank you.
Just a 5 minute. Any questions? I'm going to govern this time fairly tight because we want to give people a chance to have a break. I have 5 minutes. So are there any questions? As you can see, we are covering a very diverse set of topics in each session, and it's challenging to focus on a single topic. But I wanted to see if there are any questions. Yes. One sec. Let's get a mic.
Thanks, Susie. That was a good talk on celiac. I see a lot of patients with Down syndrome, and it's never been clear to me whether just having Down syndrome puts you at increased risk for inflammatory diseases like celiac, or do they have to also have the DLA test, the DQ?
Yeah, microphone. We get a mic. Hey, come in here.
My short answer is I don't know. But I suspect it's the genetics, you know. I think it has to do with the different genes that are involved with inflammation, and some of those Downs patients have the HLA types and they don't. But one thing that's interesting about Down syndrome is they have different serologic results some of the time. That was actually quite a big problem with the anti-endomysial antibody, which is actually quite similar with tissue transglutaminase. I haven't seen much follow-up on the literature for that, but there certainly were a lot of false negative results with the anti-endomysial. So although that's not really in the literature for the TTG and the other serology, I'm actually very nervous about saying a Down's patient doesn't have celiac disease, and I do more biopsies on them. I know that wasn't really your question, though, but I don't have the actual answer.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Yes.
I think it's a bit less of a question, but it's my understanding that the eugenics movement was the predecessor to and led to the euthanasia movement. Moreover, and I think what's important about that is not so much the Nazi connection, it's the fact that the eugenics movement itself was thought to be a progressive movement. It comes from the left, not from the right. And an over-identification with the right tends to miss the point, I think, and allows us to ignore, I think, what Dr. Somerville said, which is that we're all only trying to make the world a much better, happy place. And that's, again, it's often a progressive notion, and I think that's where it all gets lost. So I think it's important to preserve that connection myself. In the States, we had Oliver Wendell Holmes, the most famous jurist in the U.S., said in a trial for involuntary sterilization of a mentally ill woman who was never examined by her physician, said that three generations of idiocy enough and simply granted involuntary sterilization. And that was roughly the same time period. So it's really not just the right.
Thank you for the comment. Any other questions? Yes, please.
Life and death are the fundamental questions for physicians and medicine in general. We have heard a very spirited presentation on it, but I wish to emphasize that these questions are not resolved yet. They are still in development of understanding as well as our stand towards them. And they should be coordinated with legal aspects as well as with religious aspects.
Thank you. So one more. As a matter of fact, as you're asking a question, if you don't mind, introduce yourself as very quickly your name and what year, which I know who you are, but for everybody else to know, John. We're going to take one more question.
John Morrow, class of 89. It's for Ron. I know you're not an anesthesiologist, but you've given me seeds for nightmares of exploding eyeballs. Why aren't the patients put to sleep for the surgery if a single cough can blind them and mess up the OR?
The answer is really that the reason is that if you had to structure your main OR on days where you have to pre-book all these patients and you find out 24 hours in advance if you have tissue because it only clears the day before, it becomes very, very difficult to run an OR smoothly. So we can, yeah, because you might have two or three transplants booked, and now all of a sudden you've got a morning where you're not going to be doing surgery, or you're trying at the last minute to get people in. And it's been proven to be very safe to do it under local anesthesia, but you have to make sure that you take care of the patients who are at highest risk, the obese patients. You can't put them in a little bit of a Trendelenburg position. That'd be awful. There are things that you can do. So the expulsive hemorrhages, if they happen, they happen. They happen rarely. But, I mean, there's not much you can do when those things happen. Those things can happen during cataract surgery, too. So it's not just uniquely a problem for transplants.
Okay, one more. So I can imagine now, I think you're getting a good sense why many of these topics don't really do very well in one session because you get absolute ends of the spectrum. Aaron?
Yeah, I have so many questions I can't begin.
So,
I'm
so
Aaron Solnit,
so hold on.
1989.
Yeah. This is the last question.
This is really a housekeeping question, but would it be possible to put your slides somewhere online with some contact information so we can throw our questions at you via email?
Let me see. Is Maya? We can do this? We will do that.
Awesome, thank you.
And we will not use Facebook, right? We will. And we will not have Mladen send any emails. We'll avoid that. Okay, first, I really wanted to thank everybody who agreed to speak today, especially for Dr. Somerville, to come and be so graciously here. Thank you very, very much. You all get 20 minutes to eat, and then we want you back in here sharp at 20. It's going to run tight. Thank you. Ron.
don't think those are.
Is that?
I don't know.
Oh, that's old?
Yeah. I don't know what are those.
Or maybe it's the next section?
Yeah, maybe.
Any case, I put the PowerPoints from this morning in here. So not all of these, none of them are for the next session, right?
For
the session coming up.
For the after the break?
After the break, yeah.
Yeah, no, there's...
There are some?
Yeah. Okay.
For after the break? Okay, maybe take them out and put them back on the desk.
So how's this go on? Like, it just goes on right here?
Hey guys, can somebody on the top row just check to see if there's anybody still waiting outside? Can somebody check to see in the hallway anybody still in coffee mode? Okay, we're going to get started with our next. Are you going to mic up our speakers, or Ed? Do you have a mic on or no? You have it? Great. Okay, if we could get started. So we have two outstanding speakers, and then I will speak in that order. And we will wrap up with a question and answer session at the end of the three talks. Our first speaker in the second session is Dr. Ed Harvey. Ed completed medicine with us in the class of 89. He then quit medicine and went into orthopedic surgery. He completed his I think it makes sense, no? He completed his orthopedic surgery training at Duke and Harborview in Seattle. We were quite surprised by this turn of actions. As you remember, Ed was one of the most sensitive and empathetic people in our class. And the choice of this specialty was shocking. He joined the faculty at McGill in 1997. He has served on multiple national and international boards, including as president of the Canadian Orthopedic Association. He leads McGill's musculoskeletal research axis, which is a very big deal here at the McGill University Health Center, and is the Hornstein Chair of Surgical Excellence. Again, another tremendous accolade to his accomplishments. He is a director of orthopedic trauma at MUHC and professor of surgery at McGill. His research focus, funded through numerous national and international funding agencies, focuses on bone healing. So that was the boring stuff. Of most importance, utmost importance, he is married to José Parent in the class of 90, not nearly as cool as our class. She actually, Ed and José, actually introduced me to my wife, so I owe a lot of thank yous to both José, and actually not so much to Ed, just to José. They have three kids, 16, 13, and 18, and they live here in Montreal. Ed will speak about avascular necrosis of the hip, not your father's Oldsmobile anymore.
Thanks so much, Ramin. I'm just going to talk about one of the things I do. I'm really an orthopedic traumatologist, so I have lots of spare time, so I run two labs, or I'm involved in two labs, and one of them is on bone healing, and one of them is a mechanical engineering lab. I'm going to talk a little bit about the bone healing lab today. I'm also going to do a little bit of the dean's job. These are my disclosures. The dean's definitely, or dean representative, is going to come around and ask you for some money. He's not here today right now. We did a very good job, Ramin, last night, raising money in our 89 class. But people say, why should I give money? Well, the medicine's been very good. And you say, well, I'm smart. I got into medicine. And it's me that did this. But you always stand on the shoulders of other people when you get into medicine. I think I was very lucky to get into McGill, coming from Ontario. Would be much harder right now, obviously. And I think that McGill Medicine has helped me a lot. Over the last year, I've been many places, from the world's largest economic centers to the smallest in Arkansas, as well as giving lectures in New Zealand, South Africa, and other countries around the world. And it's all because of my education in McGill Medicine, I think. McGill Medicine also allowed me to participate in the city, in that we take care of three of the sports teams, and for 5 years I was fortunate enough to be the head orthopedic surgeon for the Canadien. So that was a good thing. I think my kids actually enjoyed unfettered access to the Bell Center, which was very impressive, and they were very unhappy when I gave up that job. However, I've gone on to take care of three other teams, which are much more important. I have Stephanie, who's playing Novice A intercity hockey. Alex is playing at Colors Notre Dame, and Carolyn made the midget AAA team for Quebec. So plan for today is to give you no numbers, because it's a mixed group of people. So I was going to talk about AVN. It seems like a very specialized thing to talk about. However, anyone who gives steroids in their practice runs across AVN. So I can show of hands. Anyone prescribe steroids in the room? So there we go. So most room does, including orthopedic surgeons. And it's become a big problem because every time someone with on steroid use, whether it's minor or major, develops hip pain, they need an MRI, and they need x-rays, they need CT scan, they need a bone scan. The cost to the healthcare system, someone on steroids who develops hip pain, is huge. And we thought we'd change that with our research. But basically, when I came back in 1997, we had a clinical problem, avascular necrosis of the hip. It was an ongoing problem. We really didn't know what caused it. Everyone thought that you had a blood clot somewhere in your body, and that means you had a tendency to blood clot in your bone, and the hip was more prone to that, and you had bone collapse, hip collapse, arthritis, and you couldn't do anything about it. And that basically, we cut it out and replaced it and got on with our life. It's a huge cost, especially in a young patient when you're looking at three or four hip revisions over the course of a lifetime. It's a big problem. Diagnosis is very simple. As I said, everyone does MRIs. We can diagnose AVN, we just don't know what causes it. So we set about, in 97 when I came back, I set about to do some things about it. We know that about 20% of the total hips, probably worldwide, are caused by for the cause of AVN. And in the States alone, about somewhere between 10 and 50,000, we can't agree on the numbers, per year are done just in the United States. Treatments are all suboptimal. Most are often palliative, not curative. Multiple revisions are a problem, as I mentioned. And the current treatment is just for the symptoms, not for the disease. All we do is cut it out. And non-surgical therapy is desperately needed, and the surgeons really love it when I say this is a non-surgical problem. They don't like me at all. They don't ask me back to the AVN talks anymore. So we're currently unable to identify those at risk for osteonecrosis, although we think we can. And it's a huge cause for malpractice suits. And many people practice defensive medicine, and you know, people think one dose of Ryanair will cause AVN. Well, it won't, but the lawyers do, so that's all that matters. So I think it's a major problem. When we graduated from med school, these were the major things we thought caused AVN. You know, there's caseload disease. Everyone got that in the multiple choice exam. A bunch of coagulopathies, but mostly glucocorticoids and alcohol accounted for almost 100% of them. Since then, however, there's been many things that thought caused AVN, including high stool porcelain and serum helium, and that go on to cause AVN. And if you don't practice medicine properly and don't hit all these risk factors, then you're in trouble. So to us, it seemed kind of strange that so many things cause this problem. And it's not like it's going away. Glucocorticoid use is going up, not down. It's being given for multiple things. I mean, I won't give a show of hands for people on glucocorticoids in the room, but I won't do that. But most people have had it. And in certain populations, it's very high, the rate of AVN. So in bone marrow transplant, SLE, and ALL. And the ALL population I'm going to talk about a little later because we have a current prospective study going on with ALL patients. 40% of people with ALL get AVN. You'd really like to know why, and it'd be a good population to pick up on. So AVN, mostly caused by alcohol and steroids. But if all alcoholics had AVN, then everyone in Quebec would have AVN. So it's not even close to that. So something else is going on. There has to be some kind of double hit, a genetic susceptibility, or something else going on, or we wouldn't get to do these great operations, which are not so great. So right now, this is what we do. Up in the upper right-hand corner, we either replace with a piece of metal, cut the head off, put something on. I do the operation in the bottom left, which is pre-vascularized fibular grafting. It's a very lucrative and exciting operation, but it's something we probably shouldn't be doing. We probably should have some kind of medical therapy for these patients. So when we came back, we started this transdisciplinary team at McGill to understand what caused idiopathic AVN. And it's a group of hematologists, orthopedic surgeons, and medical geneticists, really just three of us, because no one else believed it was a big problem. But it was the only way to attack this problem. So we set about figuring out why people get AVN. And this is a very busy slide, because it has to be a busy slide in order to illustrate the point. This is if I take all those stool, porcelain, helium things and put it on this one slide. This is what causes AVN. This is the mechanism they think, or we think, that causes AVN. But if you really think about it, everything acts through this, focal thrombosis. So in 1997, we didn't even have a picture. We didn't know if there was focal thrombosis. But we think there is. And if you think of all these things where we don't really know the mechanisms and what causes AVN, if you think of just one principle, Occam's razor, that the simplest answer is the correct answer, then if we figure out what causes that focal thrombosis, we'll probably be able to either get a biomarker to show who's getting AVN, which would be really important because we'd know early on if we have to stop steroids or not, or we'll get some kind of pathway where we'll figure out what to treat it with rather than cutting it out. And so finally, someone in 2001 got a picture of it. They said, look, there's a thrombus in the subchondral cancellous bone in AVN. It does occur. The elusive event was photographed. So why does that occur? Well, it's probably something to do with what's happening at the local level, at the endothelial blood interface. It's not a disease of bone. I was always taught it was a bone disease. You had bad bone and you got AVN because you got steroids. Your bone wasn't strong enough. Well, it's not. It's really probably a disease of the endothelium. And endothelial disease, as many of you know, so it's really taken off. William Aird in Boston used to have a little textbook about this thick. Now it's two volumes in the last 6 years, you know. So endothelial disease is a hot topic. So the etiology for non-traumatic AVN is probably something that happens at the venous and capillary level and might extend out of there, but might just stay there. And it's really a reduction of blood flow, and eventually you get bone death if you don't have any blood flow. So why? Well, is it due to systemic factors? Is it something like you have a clotting factor wrong? Or is it something local at the endothelium? That was the debate when we started. So endothelium, we thought, was involved in AVN because it's really there where there's this kind of reaction where the coagulation and the anticoagulation occurs, and it's really essential to what goes on at the end in the blood vessels itself. And the concept of what was called vascular bed-specific disease or problems with hemostasis and hypercoagulable states was in 2001, we saw it at the ISTH in Paris, something called regional endothelial bed dysfunction. So you have a disease of an endothelium, but it's not a systemic disease. It's a phenotypic expression at one organ level. And the slide that really does that concept for me is this one. So if you think, okay, people have systemic defects in coagulation, then they should all clot all over the body, right? Well, they don't. So you see people with congenital deficiencies of protein C and protein S, they get DVT of the lower and upper limbs, but they don't get DVTs in their head. Factor V laden, they get DVTs in their brain. They don't get but not for other diseases. Warfarin-induced, just in the sub-Q to adipose tissue, no DVT anywhere else, or no VT anywhere else. TTP, all the organs, but not the liver and lungs. Why? It's really systemic. It should happen everywhere. Well, it's not hard to understand that the endothelial cell is different at every level. Every different disease, every different organ has a different type of endothelial cell, and therefore there's a different phenotypic expression at every different organ. So why not bone? So we thought maybe that there was a regional endothelial bed dysfunction at the level of bone. So we had a study design. It was a pilot study when we first started, and it was a bunch of non-traumatic AVN patients, not a total homogenous patient. It wasn't all glucocorticoids. We took blood samples and buccal smears. We were looking to see what was going on. It was a very small group, 23 patients. And really what we did was to compare it to the literature. And the problem with our research when we started was that the literature was polluted. So they had a bunch of papers, mostly by a gentleman named Gluick in the States, who published these marker studies. But he did it on patients that didn't have AVN and that had traumatic AVN. And then he said, well, this is it. And everyone accepted it as the gold standard. And every time you went to write a paper or write a grant, they'd go, well, you don't have the same percentages as Gluick. And you try to explain to them, well, he did it on 26 traumatic AVNs, you know, people in car accidents. How can I have the same results? I'm just doing glucocorticosteroids. So a lot of it was overcoming this bias. So we looked at just comparing our patients to his patients and seeing what was different. And we were different in many ways, similar in other ways in some of the factors. But the one thing we noticed that we had an elevated level of von Willebrand factor, and no one else had measured for it, so we thought, okay, we're the first to find this. And it's really a marker of endothelial cell activation. So we said, well, something is going on at endothelial cell level. Even though we only have 23 patients, it's a snapshot, it's only a single blood test, we thought maybe we had something. So we did a second pilot study with a slightly larger group through our AVN clinic at the Montreal General Hospital, and we looked at really just GCS patients mainly. Oops. We looked at a bunch of different tests. We looked at activation of the systemic inflammation and endothelium activation, and they were both high. And we felt at that time that we probably had something with this regional endothelial bed dysfunction in bone. So we really thought, okay, we need to do a better study. We can't just do this stuff that is retrospective review stuff. We had a very small sample, which is 49, which is fairly large for the literature, but we thought it was too small. It was really just a no control group, and it was just a single blood test at any point of their disease. So we took this data and we proposed a model, which we had published in a number of. This is just a story. I just want to point out it's a story that I'm kind of walking through over the last 15 years, about 30 publications, but it's the way we came to the conclusion at the end. So we published this, and people thought that it was an interesting way of looking at it, that you'd have endothelial dysfunction, and this would perpetuate this feedback loop where you'd have thrombus formation and apoptosis, and you'd eventually end up with AVN. So our plan in going forward in the future was to look at steroids only. So we're really still looking to get that biomarker so that everyone who prescribes glucocorticoids does not have to worry about getting MRIs every week on your patients. We went through a number of logical steps that we thought we'd look at patients, but we really need to do some ex vivo studies, look at isolating endothelial cells from diseased bone, microarray candidate gene analysis, and then looking at an animal model. So we started with HUVEX because they're really easy to get, right? The human umbilical vein endothelial cells. We thought, well, if they show any promise, we'll worry about trying to find endothelial cells in bone because we still weren't sure they existed. So we did high-dose dexamethasone on HUVEX, and we got all the results we thought we would. We got endothelial cell activation. We got all the inflammatory markers, and we said, okay, we've got something. Let's get the cells out of the patient. So We went about that, and unfortunately, no one had ever done that. So we had to figure out a way to do that, and we did. We harvested, the orthopedic surgeons harvested bone from their avian hips, and we drew them out, and we ended up with cell cultures, which we were able to then use to look and see whether these were unique cells, unique endothelial cells. So at the same time, we're looking for an animal model. And you can only imagine if we're making a diagnosis by MRI using a mouse might not be the right model. So we did agree that we'd have to go some kind of rodent. We agreed on rat, and if you look at that, you can almost imagine there's avian in that rat. But so it's difficult. We knew we'd have to go to histology to really get it. So we looked at trying to find a rat model. And we looked at 7 inbred rat lines, and we did a prednisone implantation model 2 times, 90 days. And we looked at them on x-rays and histology. And we found that we could do it. We found that we got AVN. You can see in the bottom, the hips look a little smaller and a little more diseased. And we had a rat model. And what was really interesting is that we found AVN in all the rat lines except one. There was one that was protective. And we found a really high rate of AVN in another line. So now we had a super expressor and a cure to rat lines that we could compare. And we thought, wow, we're going to get the gene right. So we were able to take our techniques and isolate the endothelial cells from the rat femoral head and do all the same things we did before. And we started really looking for a biomarker. And the biomarkers can't be something that develops late. You can't say, oh, I've got AVN on an MRI. The patient's got arthritis. Let's look for the biomarker. You're too late. You need the biomarker from 2 years ago, right? You need to have something that's expressed early. So that was going to make it harder because it's sort of a fleeting response you're trying to find at first dosage of glucocorticoids. And so we knew it wasn't going to be that easy. So we took an in vivo rat model and we did the Wistar Kyoto rats, which were AVN super producers. And we went through the same technique looking at them. And a lot of information on this. But basically, we found a lot of upregulated genes, as you would expect with any model. We had things that the activation proteins in the endothelium were really up elevated. And we thought that was a great thing. And we found an interesting candidate gene and protein, which alpha-2 macroglobulin, which is one of these highly preserved proteins throughout life. And it's in all organisms. But it seemed to be there at the right time in our rat model. It was early, it stayed up in our super producers, and it disappeared in our curative rats in the fissure. So we said, that's an early marker. And if you put it into a program called Ingenuity, and you look where it is in the chain, it's in a great place. It's right after the glucocorticoid receptor signaling. It's right in the middle of all the bone proteins, and in the middle of the endothelial activation proteins. It triggers COL2A1, which we know was the only genetic marker before for AVN. So we knew we probably had the right area in the map to find the marker. And it was really interesting because it does a lot of things, alpha-2M. You can't get away from what else it does in the body. But it stops the IL-1 and the MMP-13 cascade, which causes arthritis. So that was a really kind of neat thing. And it affects BMP-1, which is part of the bone process. And we know it's on the endothelial cells. So if you activate your endothelial cells, then you produce A2M. So that's a good thing. So we were thinking, wow, we might have found it. So we still are not sure. Well, no, I'm pretty sure. Anyway, so we knew that if we could explore this a little bit better in other models, we might be able to say, okay, this is it for humans too. So we went about then and we did another study where we compared the two groups, not just the prospective cohort with the super producer. And we compared the Wistar Kyoto, which is a super producer, with the Fisher, who are protective. And we did the same model, pellet replaced at day 90, followed up micro-CT and histology. And we found that we had a sustained alpha-2M in the Wistar side and not in the Fisher side. So we were pretty sure at that point we had a biomarker. It was before arthritis set in, so that's it. We had a biomarker for rats, right? So we decided we'd go back to that group I talked about before 40% of ALL patients get AVN, right? So that's because, that's for a number of reasons, probably part of the metabolic, part of the genetic, but we know that 40% of them get it. A lot of them survive, but they have high dose of GCS to survive. And if we could follow those people in a more meaningful way, like with serial MRIs, blood tests, DNA swabs, we might be able to determine if this was really a biomarker. So we have three participating centers with sick kids, Shu St. Justin and Montreal Children's, and two adult, Princess Margaret in Toronto and the MUHC. And we're looking at the circulating alpha-2M in humans undergoing treatment and following them in a very structured way in order for us to avoid that snapshot in time and that would not, you know, that we're going to miss our window where the alpha-2M or whatever marker is elevated. So I just want to mention a couple other brief things we did in the lab is that while we're taking care of these patients, a guy came in and he said, "Oh man, I've had hip pain in my right side, and it's bad." And we did had an MRI and it showed AVN. He goes, "You know, a funny thing is I had hip pain in my left side last year, and I took an aspirin a day, and like my hip pain went away. What do you think that was?" And I was going, "Wow, you know, like, so this is one of these things, you know, if an aspirin is good for the endothelium of the heart, why wouldn't it be good for an endothelium of the hip, right?" So this, we did MRI on the other side of the guy, had resolving AVN lesion. So he had treated correctly his early stage AVN with a baby aspirin a day. So we said, "Wow, we have to find out why." So we started our prospective pilot study with a number of hips that we just kind of followed up. We gave everybody in our clinic aspirin just because we thought that was the ethical thing to do. We thought it was curable. No, Iris to come and talk to me about it. So so we found when we went back and looked at the group that we had very little progression in the early stage AVN that we just put on a baby aspirin. So we said, "Well, there you go. We just cured AVN, right?" So if you get it early enough. So it's a huge thing, I thought. And then we just, so it's a very good example of bedside to bench to bedside. And it was simple. And it just took something weird for an orthopedic surgeon, talking to the patient. You all know me. You know I didn't do the talking, right? So anyway, we know what ASA does in endothelium, and we were very excited about it. And I think that we have a larger prospective study ongoing right now to see if that really is an effect or it's just it's a small study. And the last thing I was going to mention, we talk about systemic genetic defects and a phenotype happening at the regional bed, but there are some families that have been described that have AVN in the family, and all of them have been in Asia, but we found a cohort here in North America. It's the only one in the world where there actually is a three-level cohort with end-stage AVN, and we're looking at verifying what gene it is. With all the other ones have been mutations that call 2A1 gene, which you saw in that ingenuity chart where the AM to alpha-2M is. But we found that it's really factor ON4 in this patient, and we're working on getting that published in the New England Journal right now. In conclusion, osteonecrosis is a complex multifactor disease. If you want to attack a disease like this, you really need a big team, committed team. Things are going to happen that at the bedside that might change how you think about the disease, and you have to be open to that. I think that this is really a disease of endothelium. It's not a disease of bone. I think that the time of surgeons treating this disease is over very soon. And I think that although genetic predisposition is a factor, it's not the big factor. Thank you.
Thank you. Terrific. Okay. So my hip hurts after listening to that talk. Okay. Our next speaker... let's see, Kevin Schwartzman, Dr. Kevin Schwartzman, who's going to speak to us about the title of a talk is Forgotten But Not Gone. It's a movie. Come into a theater near you. It's Tuberculosis 1989 to 2014. So Kevin, after graduating with our class, completed his internal medicine residency at Montreal General Hospital and his respirology subspecialty residency at the Integrated McGill Program. He obtained his MPH degree from Harvard in quantitative methods track, and in 1995 began his faculty appointment in respiratory division within the Department of Medicine at McGill. He was director of the residency training program in respirology from 2008 to 2013, and in 2014 became professor of medicine and director of respiratory division at McGill. He has longstanding clinical and research interests in tuberculosis and has held research funding from a bunch of things with acronyms in Canada. You would understand FRQS and CHIR, and these are not just Quebec organizations. These are Canadian organizations. As principal investigator, and he's been continuously funded since 1997, which is a huge accomplishment. Much more important than all of that, absolutely, is the fact that he's married to our classmate, Christine Leglaire, and their children, aged 19 and 17, Kevin. And by the way, he was very gracious to agree to speak today, so I pulled on him.
Thank you. So just a couple of comments at the outset. I hope you can all hear me. So one is, I guess it was about a month or two ago, I got a phone call, and as most of you probably do, I have call display, and I got a call, it was about 10 at night, most of the time, and it was from an unknown number, I didn't recognize it. Most of the time, of course, these calls are from telemarketers, except I was a little intrigued because it was a 617 area code, and having lived in Boston, I knew where that is. I said, why would a telemarketer be calling me at 10 at night on a Saturday night from Boston? You know, usually it's an 800 number. So, of course, it was a different kind of telemarketer. It was Ramin, but anyway, he did sell his product effectively, and here I am. The second comment is that, at least for those of you in my class, we spent, I think, the bulk of our we all know we spent the bulk of our first year of medical school here in this particular room. What many of you don't know is that, thanks to anatomy, I almost spent the best 2 years of my life in this particular room. I would like to say one or two other things at the outset before we get into the talk. So one is that as Dave Eidelman kind of intimated, it is a challenging time here in Quebec for universities, and McGill is no exception. And I think it is important to recognize that the money that, for example, our class has raised really does help to ensure that we keep the best possible students, the best possible faculty, and the best possible researchers here working in the best possible environment. And although I'm certainly not a fundraiser by any stretch of the imagination, nor am I interested in becoming one, I think it is important, and I think our class going forward will want to think carefully about how we put that money to use in that regard. The other thing is that there's a lot of talk about the hidden curriculum in medicine these days, and I think there was a hidden curriculum in our day, and it's not quite as bad as the bad old days are portrayed to be. I think actually the hidden curriculum in our day was one of diversity, one of support. One of my favorite memories of medical school is people working together whom you never could have imagined would speak to each other, let alone work effectively together, and they did so repeatedly. And I think that actually was part of the hidden curriculum and is an attribute of our class. And the other thing is that, as we saw last night and perhaps to some degree after the coffee break today, we don't do well with authority, our particular class, and that's actually an excellent attribute, and it's something we should actually continue to foster. I have no conflicts of interest. So in terms of the objectives for this talk, I'm going to talk briefly about the role of serendipity in life and career. Then I'm going to switch gears and talk a little bit more about the advertised topic, which is the history and extent of the TB epidemic in the last 25 years. I'm going to talk about some major challenges and also some potential ways forward, and I will try to keep to my time limit. So serendipity in life, as I guess we all did, we entered our class in 1985. With about 160 others, and during medical school, I met, dated, and later married my wife and partner in love, life and parenthood, who's already been alluded to. And I think one of the nice things about our class, Susie was pointing this out, is I think we have five couples in our class. We have many other couples associated with nearby classes, Ed and Jose, Judith, many, many others. And I guess in part that's serendipity, but I like to think it also has to do with some of the choices we made, both in terms of where we chose to go to school, but also whom we chose to be with. And this is a picture of my family at the occasion of my daughter's high school graduation, and you can see my son on the left looking a bit hippie-ish. He's since fixed that, but but as I said, we're a tolerant group, and my kids' grandparents as well. a little bit about serendipity in career. So I think it's fair to say that in both the undergraduate or the MDCM program and my own internal medicine training at the MGH, which was excellent, I must say, the focus was really on clinical experience and mastery. And at that time, research was not really on the radar. There was a lot of talk about, you know, famous researchers giving us medical school lectures. Frankly, a lot of them were terrible lecturers, but that's a separate issue. Let's just say that we didn't necessarily have some of the role models that we might have benefited from. I don't know why exactly, but respirology was the only elective in my entire first year of internal medicine residency, but it was a fantastic elective, and really after that, nothing else compared in my view. Interestingly, when I moved to respirology, clinical expertise was still first and foremost, and it is to this day. We will not hire somebody whom we don't feel utterly confident in as a clinician and colleague, but a little bit differently from what I'd experienced before, our research experience and output were also emphasized and, in fact, highly valued. And it was pretty much at that time that my earlier so-called liberal arts experience, which some of you may know about, came back to haunt me, and I began to work in tuberculosis, which really, as many of you have heard, it's a sort of truism that TB is a social disease with medical aspects. I was also lucky enough to receive excellent advice from my peers in the respirology training program in those days about whom I might work with as a research supervisor and ultimately mentor. So in this slide, you see a portrait of our small respirology resident group when I graduated, with a lot more hair, a lot less gray. A lot of this is thanks to the new MUHC, so thank you very much for that. On the upper right, you see my research supervisor and mentor, Dick Menzies, and on the lower right, actually David Eidelman, who was, after Manuel Cusi was in the middle photo there, was my division director for actually a very formative time in my career, and an excellent role model as well. And here is just to show you that, in fact, something that was not really known to me before I joined the respiratory division as a resident in the early 90s was the incredible figures, the incredible science and clinical care and research output that had come from this group. And you see actually in the upper left corner, Dr. Christie, who in fact was the grandfather of our classmate Gene Seeley and was a absolutely world-class leader in respirology, in physiologic research in respirology, was the chair of medicine at the Vic and McGill, and really a key figure in the history of this institution. On the right, you see Dr. Paré, who died actually just over a year ago, who was a phenomenal teacher, and those of you in respirology and radiology will know him as the author of Fraser and Paré, a seminal textbook. On the lower right, you see Dr. Becklake, who was the founder of my own research unit and an inspiring figure at a time where there were very few women in academic medicine, and an absolutely top-notch clinician, researcher, and humanitarian. And finally, at the bottom left, Dr. Macklem, who sadly died also several years ago, but was really, again, a world leader in respiratory physiology and literally told us much of what we know today about airways disease, about COPD, and so on and so forth. Now, on to TB. I certainly don't remember having a medical school lecture on this topic. Maybe some of you do. But I'd like to pair that with the following clinical vignette. So this is the case of a 20-year-old young man born in Peru but who had lived in Canada for several years, who had no past medical history of any variety, and presented with a sudden onset of very severe chest pain and shortness of breath about a week after returning from a visit home by airplane. And this was his chest radiograph shortly after emergency management. And you can see, obviously, there's a chest tube on the left side. You can also see that there's a hydropneumothorax. You can see that there's, in fact, parenchymal disease on both sides. And this is a CT scan showing some of the same image, showing some of the same phenomena with the hydropneumothorax and the parenchymal disease, actually dense consolidation on the left side and patchy consolidation on the right. So, in fact, what happened with this young man was he was found to have positive cultures for Mycobacterium tuberculosis on pleural fluid as well as bronchoalveolar lavage. In fact, this was found to be multi-drug resistant and was probably primary, meaning that this man had no antecedent history of any type of TB treatment or exposure to TB drugs, and so presumably had become latently infected at some point with a multi-drug resistant organism, which is actually quite prevalent in Peru. As a consequence of this, he was hospitalized for over 3 months with a bronchopleural fistula. By the way, he was HIV negative, and ultimately, after a very challenging treatment course that lasted 2 years, was ultimately cured and went back to school and work and so forth. One comment here is that none of this would have been possible without an incredible multidisciplinary care team, and that's another sort of lesson of work here in the McGill system, is that, and certainly work with TB, is that without incredible medical, nursing, laboratory colleagues, none of this would be possible, of course. So why did we not hear much about TB in med school? So these curves show, on the one hand, on the upper portion panel, national TB rates. They're always expressed per 100,000 population. And you can see that, in fact, in the early 80s, there had been a very significant drop in the United States, which then plateaued around 1985 when we started medical school. And something roughly similar, maybe a little bit of a lead in New York City, where throughout the 1970s, there had been more than a 50% drop in TB incidence, which then leveled out in the late 70s and started to pick up again. But in fact, this was not initially really recognized or acted upon. And in fact, by the late 1980s, there were written predictions that TB could be eliminated in the United States by 2010. But in fact, TB programs in the U.S. were victims of their own success. It's a case of out of sight, out of mind. The funding fell out of the cellar in terms of TB control. Public health programs were disbanded. And as a result, there was a disaster in the United States. And actually, Lee Reichman, who's one of the leaders in U.S. TB care and control, called this the U-shaped curve of concern, meaning that as people paid, people thought things were good, money was taken away from TB control, and all of a sudden there was a resurgence. At the same time, something that was also changing importantly in both the U.S. and Canada were the demographics of TB. Again, we're focusing for the time being on North America. We'll move to the international sphere in a few minutes. But in fact, something that was different was that over those years, more and more of the TB was found in the foreign-born population, as there was less and less exposure to TB in the U.S. and Canada for people born here while they were growing up. And so what we see is in Canada now, about two-thirds of all TB occurs in people born outside Canada, and the same holds true for the United States. And what this means is that in terms of any TB control interventions or strategies, one has to rethink and revamp to some degree to reach these groups and understand the epidemiology a bit better. Another striking point, I think, on this slide is that throughout this entire period in Canada, Aboriginal persons continue to account for about 20% of all TB in Canada, despite being a much smaller segment of the population. So they clearly bear a disproportionate burden. And in fact, you see this in terms of incidence, where per person, Canadian-born Aboriginal people have the highest incidence, foreign-born have a medium incidence, and people born in Canada who are not Aboriginal essentially have almost eliminated TB. What's an especially striking statistic is that in Nunavut, one of our northernmost territories, obviously, the incidence of TB in 2012 was over 200 per 100,000. Which is on par with many African countries. To switch now to more global epidemiology, again, you can see that incidence per 100,000 remained roughly stable throughout the 1990s and into the early 2000s, and has finally begun to drop with essentially increased attention and funding. And with that, the prevalence of TB, meaning the number of people in the population who actually have TB at a given moment, has also decreased, as has mortality. It's also important to note that there are huge discrepancies in TB rates, so that in Canada we run about a 4 to 5 per 100,000 rate. In South Africa it's 1,000 per 100,000, meaning that 1% of the population develops active TB in any given year. And then 73 in China, about 175 in India. And obviously given the vast size of these countries' population, in fact, they account for much of the TB burden in the world today. It's estimated that close to 9 million people develop active TB disease. Many of these are not diagnosed or treated. And when I became involved with TB care and sort of research, it was a real eye-opener to recognize that things we would take for granted on any given day in the hospital or in our practice setting here simply don't exist in many parts of the world. So again, even the most basic, often smear microscopy, of course many places don't have radiographic imaging, and certainly TB cultures and what we call drug susceptibility testing, meaning antibiotic resistance testing, are kind of a pipe dream in many places. And this is something you fundamentally have to get if you're going to approach this problem in any kind of coherent or useful way. A further kind of statistic that is frankly staggering in some ways is that it's estimated that a third of the world's population carries latent TB infection, meaning that if untreated, they don't get any preventive therapy, which is often given in the U.S. and Canada, 5 to 10% of these individuals, so perhaps anywhere between 100 and 200 million people, will develop active TB accordingly in the future. There are major challenges to TB control, the HIV epidemic, the lack of diagnostic and therapeutic infrastructure, as I've mentioned, the emergence of drug resistance, so-called multi and extensively drug-resistant TB, even total drug-resistant TB in the last year or two. These conditions are much, much more difficult and expensive to diagnose and treat than is so-called garden variety, pan-sensitive TB, and is associated with substantially poorer outcomes. Another important challenge that, again, one only becomes aware of when one thinks, well, certainly outside Canada, is the existence of private versus public health systems, meaning that in many countries there is completely non-standard diagnostics and drug treatments being given by so-called private practice physicians. And there are actually quite alarming statistics in that regard, which I won't get into, but we'd be happy to discuss later. There's also an important funding gap between what is available and what is needed for direct TB patient care and control in low- and middle-income countries. There's been a lack of imagination, many people believe, attention and advocacy. And I think it's worth reflecting for a moment who in society is actually ill with TB. Typically, it's a disease of the disenfranchised and the poor, versus who controls and obtains funding for research and for clinical care, and who finally is in a position to advocate for better investments in TB care and control. And I think it's an area where we find, again, some very striking gaps, which I'd be happy to talk about later. We know that things can be improved. In fact, in New York City, which was the epicenter of the U.S. TB resurgence, there were very significant advances made that have had actually quite a lasting impact. This article, interestingly, from 1995, is by Tom Frieden, who many of you may have seen on the news recently as the director of the United States CDC, and he actually began his career as the TB controller for New York City and published this in the New England in 1995. And I think there's a couple of pretty striking quotes. So by 1992, the situation in New York looked bleak. The number of cases had tripled in 15 years. In Harlem, the case rate of, again, over 200 per 100,000 exceeded that of many third world countries. That's the phrase he used, or he and his co-authors used. What was done to get this under control, a quadrupling of TB control staff in New York City, and a tenfold increase in budget. And in fact, it's estimated that it cost the city billions of dollars to finally get this under control. But it was done. There have been increases in global funding. This is an estimate from Catherine Floyd at WHO, where you see that funding for TB control has increased from about $1 billion, $1.5 billion, to close to $4 or $5 billion. You also see the parallel increase in mean GDP per person worldwide. In fact, a lot of the increase in funding for TB control is thanks to you, because whenever you buy